Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from east of the Appalachians, an undisclosed location. Our AccuWindow forecast, 48 degrees and clear. Still reeling from the beautiful lunar eclipse we had last night. Earth is entering a minor solar wind stream that could spark auroras around the Arctic Circle, so be aware up there, you high-latitude listeners and sky watchers. And the solar wind is a screaming 505 kilometers per second. The sun has five sunspot clusters, but there's no chance for a dangerous flare right now, so you can take the foil from around your electronic devices. You don't have to store them tonight. You're safe. But I want you to get ready, you space junk hunters. Get your shopping carts ready. Get your four-wheel drives ready. Get your night vision goggles ready. And get ready for some brand new collections. Russian Mars probe Phobos Grunt, stranded in Earth orbit since its main engines failed to fire after launch on November 8th, is beginning to sink back into the atmosphere. Analysts expect re-entry to occur sometime in early to mid-January 2012. Use caution, however, when picking up pieces, because this one is still full of fuel. Remember, its main engines didn't fire. It won't be passing over the U.S. until at least a week, but the International Space Station will be coming over beginning on Tuesday, if you want to have a look at that. If you have never seen it, I can't imagine why. Maybe it's because you never look up. Or if you really want to bedazzle your friends out in the yard some evening, go to heavensabove.com, heavens-above.com. Set yourself up a user login with your location, and it will tell you the exact moment at which the International Space Station will appear overhead. And you can wow your friends. Say, hey, would you like to see a spaceship? No, really, I'm serious, a spaceship. Look up now, and it'll be quite amazing. It is very spectacular if you haven't seen it. By the way, if you have been looking for the Tiangong space station, you're not alone. It is passing over a few times between 5 and 7:30 a.m. this next week, but the solar panels aren't loaded yet, so it's a little faint right now. Wait until the next section gets added later next year. The Chinese Heavenly Palace will be visible. And so will you. Last night, if you lived on the West Coast, you got to see a full lunar eclipse. Very nice reddish-brown moon. Quite spectacular. Elsewhere in the country, it was a partial lunar eclipse. Still pretty fantastic when we see those things. You know, they happen on a fairly regular basis, the lunar eclipses. The solar eclipses are much more rare. But the lunar eclipses take place in about, depends on if it's a full lunar eclipse or not, between an hour and 40 minutes. So it's not really that long to see. And if you set up a geosynchronous or a lunar synchronous camera and time elapse it, you can. It's really quite fantastic to see. Now, we have quite a few news stories tonight. I did want to make a couple of announcements. By the way, if you want to be part of the program, and I really would encourage you to do so because there's so many cool things to talk about right now. Toll free anywhere in North America, 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471. Now, you know, be patient because Comcast, has been giving the studio fits for the last 3 days. And nobody's really happy about that. But, you know, incompetence is so rarely tolerable. You remember last year when I was down in Mississippi, we had a tremendous problem with them on that half of the city. Just, you know, whenever it rained, well, you know, it went out. If you're anywhere else on planet or off planet, if you want to get to a cell phone tower. Ah, says here, we have two lines on the T1 and one on the Comcrap, just in case. All is well now. So if you want to call in anywhere else on planet, off planet, if you can reach a cell phone tower, you can get to us at 530-413-4511. 530-413-4511. And, you know, feel free to bring up any topic you like, especially in the scientific space exploration or even paranormal. And believe me, you know, paranormal has a denotation and a connotation. The denotation is it is above normal. It is out there on the leading edge of science. It is, you know, when you're talking about explorers and then the explorer scout, the guy that's up ahead that sort of radios back to the explorers, here's where we need to go now, that's the paranormal. The connotation is that it has to do with ghosts. That's true. We did a Facebook survey just asking people, what do you think the word paranormal means? Oh, my gosh, we had everything from witches and goblins and ghosts and spirits and vapors and all kinds of stuff, but nothing to do with science. So denotation and connotation, that is the dictionary definition and then the street version of what the word means. So here on this program, we talk about the mysteries of the universe and of the earth, and we don't do ghosts. Now, that being said, one of my good friends, and he's been on the program a couple of times, both with his book, The God Experiments, and his book, The Afterlife Experiments, Dr. Gary Schwartz has just released a new book called The Sacred Promise, The Sacred Promise, and he is a best-selling author. In my last interview with him, we were discussing a double-blind experiment that he had done with John Edwards, you know, John Edwards of TV medium fame, talking to the dead on behalf of the living. And the double-blind experiments were quite impressive. Even Deepak Chopra commented on the irrefutability of his scientific methods. And I concur with that. But at the end of this, I had a question for him. And the question was, why is it that when John Edwards communicates with the dearly departed on behalf of the living, and his level of detail is quite astonishing, from knowing the name of the dog to the method of death to the whereabouts of things that only the departed person would have known, no mention is ever made of a previous life, only the most recent mortal existence on the earth as Uncle John or, you know, Grandpa Ben. Never a revelation by the dearly departed that, hey, once I got on this side, I could see everything. You're going to be amazed how many times you've lived, how much experience you have. It all comes back to me now. No, nothing like that. And so I asked him the question, and he was so intrigued by it that he started down another study. That is partially discussed in this book, and when we have him on to interview on it next month, we are going to discuss that. So, The Sacred Promise, Gary Schwartz. You might want to pick it up and read it before we go live with it. It can be bought everywhere where fine books are sold. Couple of announcements. If you're planning your events for 2012, and this is going to be a year like no other. Okay, just because of, you know, the millennial planning that's been done by ancient civilizations relative to this date. There's no small amount of mysticism and mystery and great intrigue about December 21st, 2012. You know, my co-author and I wrote 2,000 pages on it as the Arc of Millions of Years series, widely read, used in many universities as textbooks. And yet, if you want to be part of it, yeah, you want to participate in it. It's one thing to read about it. It's another to participate. And I don't mean the block party down there, the end of the world party that your friends are throwing down at the cul-de-sac. I mean going to Chichen Itza in the Yucatan. And on that date, December 21st, 2012, being at Maya Ground Zero at Chichen Itza, December 13th through 22nd, 10 days. It's a round trip from Houston. Everything is included. If you want to be part of this, it's affordable and it is going to be amazing. Because at the same area, at the same time, Sting, Carlos Santana, and a couple thousand of your best friends, I'll be there speaking. Greg Braden, others, keyed into this 2012 theme. The very, very best, most authoritative speakers on the planet at Ground Zero, December 21st, 2012. Believe me, see yourself there and begin by clicking on the orange banner at xsquaredradio.com, xsquaredradio.com. Click on that orange banner and begin your journey so you can tell your young children and your grandchildren where you were on December 21st, 2012. You'll be where it all started. We also want to let you know that this month, the Pythagoras Conference that was planned for Louisville, Kentucky, the 21st of December, has been postponed to October of 2012. It is also going to be a Midwest mecca of an event. 50 speakers, the best in the world relative to awakening and seizing the sovereign being who you know you are. You want to be part of that, get a hold of me. You can click on the blue banner at X Squared Radio, the Pythagoras Conference. However, that's going to link you up with the current website, and there's a new banner that's coming out. I just want you to put it on your calendar and, excuse me, and get ready, because I'm going to give you a week-by-week reminder. Two conferences you really have to make. By all means, make it to the Chichen Itza Maya 2012 conference. That's one of a lifetime. And then the Pythagoras conference in October. This will be an amazing year for you if you follow this path. If not, well, you're going to have to learn it from someone else, because there are a lot of amazing things happening. Now, some of the things that we discussed in the Arc of Millions of Years, specifically in Volume 2, in a chapter called The Watchers. In that chapter, we described an ancient alchemical method by which the Nephilim designed, engineered a way to take over the world through economic means, that they would create value from nothing, from some baseless metal like lead or parking lot gravel. Actually, something even more worthless, dollars. And now it's just ones and zeros. And in that book, we described a way that that the main currencies would be digested down into three or four currencies and then finally digested into one global currency. And that this would be brought about through a fabricated economic collapse, a world economic collapse. Now, at the time we wrote the books, you know, it was, we started writing post 9/11 in 2001. The first volume came out in 2004. It took us 3 years to write that book. It was almost 1,000 pages. The publisher said, no, you can't publish 1,000 pages. Cut it in half. So we cut it to 560 pages. It had a tremendous bibliography, 40 of some of the best books ever written, the Zohar, Sefer Yetzirah, the Bible, the Quran, the Book of Mormon. It just goes on, and the list was amazing. And when we tied all these cultures together into one comprehensive study, the picture became so clear, and the design became so clear. But at the same time, it became so unbelievable, because in 2004, 2005, 2006, 2007, the economy was growing. I mean, we had 4.5% unemployment. We had, you know, money was available. Businesses were starting. It was, we thought, you know, ancient predictions are one thing, but reality is another. Well, here we are, less than 6 years later, and the world, it has collapsed. Trillions and trillions of dollars in debt. Now, the science of this is so fascinating that we went out to try to find an expert who could speak on this, who could really, you know, nail what was going on, who was involved in it, what is the scope of how this is working. And I want you to realize, as I play for you this piece, and you realize how far, how deep this plan goes, you realize no human could have planned it. No generation of a secret society of humans could have planned it. Couldn't happen. It takes too long to put these forces into place. Now, that being said, the organizers, which we claim are the Nephilim, which are still here on this planet, although not out in the public view, they're behind the scenes, they're pulling the strings, they're creating the memos, they're designing the system and what it relies upon in order to make it work. And this is the most amazing methodology that seems to function. It isn't fear. It isn't subterfuge. It isn't falsehood. It is greed. Yes, they use the greed of the human being to make himself wealthy in a single lifetime, from literally nothing, to being so wealthy. And the perception of power is so intoxicating to humans that it is a fairly easy plan to carry out. Now, I have to say, this is going to be a little shocking for you to hear. I'm 99% positive that you have not heard this interview, because in order for you to hear this interview, you would have had to either subscribe to or search out a very obscure financial magazine and this particular interview. Now, I must say that I have communicated with the person who gave this interview, and her name is Ann Barnhart. And she did not agree to come on to X Squared Radio. She felt that it was not in coordination with her livelihood. She is a stockbroker. She is a commodities broker, primarily focusing upon beef, and you'll hear that. This is cattle on the hoof. You'll hear that in the interview. But once her interview got out there on the web, it became public domain. So her words are going to be heard here tonight. I did not interview her. I did not interview her, but I did communicate with her, and she's not particularly happy with what I do. So that's just where it is. So what I'm going to do here is I'm going to pull up this link, and I'm going to play for you this interview. Let's see here if I can pull it up. See if it will come up here. This is an interview that was done a few days ago. It's 32 minutes. And it's regarding MF Global's collapse. The crooks of Wall Street who lawlessly continue to rape the financial system. And, you know, it's sort of like a, I don't know, the brazenness of a serial killer. I don't mean to relate it to that, but it's sort of like that. You reach a point at which you literally do not fear the law. So listen closely. What you are about to hear is really going to blow your mind.
The Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Joining me as my special guest on the program today is Ann Barnhart, formerly of Barnhart Capital Management. And Ann, you were a commodity broker for 8 years, and then you formed your own independent brokerage for 6 years. And a couple of weeks ago, you made the painful decision to shut your doors because you felt your clients' money and positions were no longer safe. What led you to draw those conclusions?
Well, obviously, it was the MF Global collapse, and more specifically, the fallout after the MF Global collapse and the reaction by the CFTC, the SEC, and most especially by the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. The actions specifically by the Merc after the MF Global collapse were unprecedented, unfathomable, and completely and totally intolerable. The Merc itself basically did the equivalent of sticking a 9mm in their mouth and pulling the trigger. By not stepping forward, backstopping the MF Global client accounts, and at the very least, the Merc should have allowed the MF Global customers to liquidate their accounts and then transfer to other firms. What the Merc did was the worst possible thing. They froze those people out of their accounts, didn't even allow them to liquidate while the markets continued to trade. And I cannot overemphasize the importance of that, the risk that those people were exposed to in the cattle business. And my forte is cattle. I'm actually a cash cattle person. And my brokerage business was geared almost exclusively towards livestock and grain. I have a lot of contacts in the cattle industry who didn't necessarily do their futures business with me, but were contacts of mine who did do business through brokers that cleared through MF, who lost tens of thousands of dollars on hedge positions that they wanted to get out of but could not get out of in the week and a half after the MF Global collapse. This has never happened before. This was a complete breach of fiduciary duty by the Chicago Mercantile Exchange itself, to the point that it literally has destroyed the entire paradigm. I got to the point where I could no longer tell my clients that their free cash customer funds, not even exposed to the marketplace, just their cash sitting in their account, non-margined, was not safe. I couldn't tell them that their money was safe. And at that point, it was morally incumbent upon me to get my clients out of this completely dysfunctional, basically destroyed marketplace, get them off those railroad tracks, and get them away from the risk. Now, I didn't clear through MF, but with the European collapse and knowing what we know about how these financial entities are leveraged in European paper and the cascading nature of all this, I had to act before the proverbial poop hit the fan. Because if you sit around and you wait until after the poop hits the fan, it's too late. You wouldn't get anybody out. So to me, it wasn't really a painful decision. It was a complete no-brainer.
In the past, when firms went under, customer funds were intact and the exchanges would step in, as you mentioned earlier, to backstop everything to keep customers 100% liquid. And normally a quick transfer from the bankrupt firm would be immediately replaced. Why do you think they did not allow that to happen this time?
You tell me. Like I said, I'll use the word again. It's suicidal. What they did was suicidal. So you're absolutely right. Up until last month on Friday, October 31st, the customer seg funds rule was utterly sacrosanct. Even when REFCO imploded and imploded quite dramatically in 2005. No customer funds were gone. It was on the prop trading side of the company, but the customer funds were there, were accounted for, and it is the onus of the mercantile exchange to audit these FCMs. MF Global was under the auspices and under the supervision, the auditing supervision of the CME, and I believe that MF was audited not just annually, but quarterly. Also, there is the question of how in the world could the Merck miss the margin being posted? The Merck is supposed to be doing, is supposed to be moving equity and doing margin wire transfers twice a day, every day. How could those customer funds be quote unquote missing? They aren't missing. They were stolen. They were stolen by John Corzine and his cadre of associates at MF Global. So, yes, again, to your listeners who may not fully appreciate the gravity of this, this has never, ever happened before. Nothing even close to this has ever happened before. And it is the function of the mercantile exchange itself. The reason why the exchanges exist is that they stand in the middle of every transaction, and they act as the de facto counterparty to every single transaction so that, for example, my clients never had to worry about the creditworthiness of the other individual, whoever it might be, who was on the other side of any trade that they did. Now, for every buyer, there's a seller, that's right, and it's a one-for-one, it's a zero-sum game. But to ensure the creditworthiness and the integrity of the market, the function of the mercantile exchange itself is to stand in the middle of every transaction and be the guarantor. So a year ago, when Terry Duffy held a press conference and said, never in the history of the mercantile exchange has a customer ever, ever lost funds resulting from the collapse of a firm, he was telling the truth a year ago. Everything changed on Halloween of this year, though, and that's why I had to shut the doors of my brokerage, because I could not in good conscience continue forward knowing that the mercantile exchange was no longer going to fulfill their fiduciary duty.
In the futures market to begin with, which is highly leveraged, if you open up a futures contract, you're usually leveraged 10 to 1. So they require exceptional firm base on which to function. And the major integrity of the whole system is the segregation of customer funds. That was breached by MF Global. And let's not sugarcoat this, Ann. Basically, management stole all of the non-margin cash, invested it in highly speculative securities. And what has astonished me has been the reaction of the exchange and regulators. Where's the investigation into John Corzine?
Well, that's the point of this. We are now living in a lawless, Marxist, communist, usurped, what used to be a representative republic, but is no more. This is no longer a nation of laws. This is now transformed into a nation of men. It doesn't matter what crime you commit. In the case of John Corzine, this man has stolen in excess of $1 billion. I think by the time it's all panned out, it's going to be closer to $3 billion of customer funds that he stole. Why did he do that? Is he stupid? Well, of course he's not stupid. This is a former head of Goldman Sachs. This man doesn't have a low IQ per se. Why in the world would a man wake up in the morning one day and say, you know what? I think I'm going to steal all the customer seg funds in this FCM that I'm running, which is the biggest FCM in the country. Yeah.
Now, the reason that this is important is you realize that John Corzine and his leadership, they were not stupid. They knew exactly what they were doing. They knew what they were doing was illegal. They knew that, and as you have seen in the news, but you probably didn't know what was going on because you didn't know about this interview. You didn't know from financial experts what really has happened. Oh, you've seen John Corzine in front of Congress. You've seen him say, I'm stunned. I'm astonished. I have no idea where that money went. That's stupidity. John Corzine is not stupid. Now, what you are about to hear will explain to you how deep and how wide this corruption goes. Does it go to the White House? You tell me. Does it go beyond the White House? I think so. I think it goes all the way to the Nephilim. Now, you listen very carefully how these authorities, who were so willing to take Enron apart and put people in jail, so willing to take Madoff's organization apart, so much so that at least one person in his organization committed suicide. Why are they not doing it this time? Listen closely.
CM in the country. Yeah, that sounds like a good plan. No. Why would a man like that even engage in a nefarious plot like this? Because he knew going into it that he could get away with it. And the reason he could get away with it is because he is in tight with the Obama regime. He is one of Obama's top fundraisers. Earlier this year, John Corzine had a fundraiser dinner at his New York City apartment for Barack Obama, where it was charged at $35,000 a plate. Okay? He bundled high six figures for Obama in one evening. He is a crony of the regime. This is Marxist communism. There is no rule of law. And these people, these poor MF customers, are just sitting out here helpless to do anything because there is no law enforcement, because this is no longer a nation of laws. The rule of law no longer exists. There is no longer justice in this nation. And no nation, no culture, no society can survive if there isn't a foundation of justice. That is why we are teetering on the precipice of collapse, and I foresee civil war coming.
Now, I have to emphasize here that she may be talking about civil war because she's angry. Her firm is out of business. She's not making money right now. You can hear this in the energy of her voice. But you have to understand that these people that had their money in accounts that were affected by MF Global were not the poor. They're middle class. These are people that put their hard-earned money in there so it could go to work. And they trusted the managers at MF Global to make safe and wise investments with their money. These are 401ks. These are pensions. These are IRAs and Roth IRAs that working people have put in there, sweating their entire lives to put their life savings in these accounts. And that's enough. When you bring somebody that may have a half a million or $750,000 in these accounts, and they've worked their whole life putting money in since they were in their 20s and now they're in their 60s, they see it evaporate and there's no recourse. There's nothing they can do because this man and his leadership simply dipped into their account, even if their money wasn't invested, even if it was just sitting in the bank, just cash sitting in the bank. They took it. They just took it. And that's why she feels this way. Let's continue.
War coming within the next several years.
You know, we had Gerald Celente on this program, and he had an account with Lynn Waldock. And he's been trading futures and gold. He had a plan, and when he built up enough, he would take delivery on gold. They stopped him out of his trade, sequestered his margin or his cash, and forced him out of a trade and closed his account. So what you're talking about, because the exchange did not backstop and then froze customer accounts, they forced probably, and would you say millions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars of losses on these customers?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. If we're talking several billion in customer seg funds, then the losses that were incurred could easily, by the customers in that week, week and a half that they were frozen out, could easily get into the hundreds of millions. It might even breach into the low billions. No question about that. And yeah, and even with options, you know, I've talked to cattlemen who have had put options on as hedges to put a floor underneath the price of cattle. Okay, so imagine this. You buy a put option 4 months ago. You pay the premium.
Okay, a put option is where you're betting that the price will go down. People usually use it as a hedge. Now, normally most of their money is betting on things going up, but you have to have a hedge. Yeah, you're going to lose your money if the price goes up, but if the price goes down, it's a hedge against you losing everything. And usually there are higher odds, especially if the market is moving up. So you actually get a larger return if the price goes down than if it goes up. Now, listen to what happened.
Yeah. You post that money. Then this happens. you're frozen out of your account. Your account gets transferred to another firm without your consent. By the way, none of the customers were allowed any input into this. Their accounts were just sent to RJ O'Brien and other firms like that without their consent. And then once the positions were transferred, even if it was a risk-limited position like a long put option, then the new clearing firm called them the next morning after the trade settled and said, okay, there was no equity in your account because all that money got stolen, so you're going to have to pay the premium for this put option again. So it's doubling the cost, essentially, for a lot of these people out here who are dealing just in what's supposed to be the very risk-limited paradigm of long options. The entire situation could not have been handled any worse, and it, in fact, I would take it a step further. It was handled so poorly, I can't imagine that these people are that stupid at the Merck and at the CFTC and so forth. I can't believe that the bankruptcy trustee is that stupid. This almost seems like it was so bad that it had to have been nefarious.
You know, Anne, you believe that MF Global is just the tip of the iceberg, that there's massive industry exposure to European sovereign debt. In fact, the day you and I are doing this interview, the Fed just engineered a major swap with central banks. It was a central bank love fest on Wednesday of group money printing. So that tells me that central banks acting in unison the way they did on Wednesday, that they're afraid that there's something big out there that is about to happen, and they're trying to maybe plug a hole in the dike.
Well, if anybody out there understands fourth grade arithmetic, you know for a metaphysical certitude that Europe is done. Europe is mathematically impossible. It cannot be saved. I mean, you want to make a start. You even want to make a start at trying to bail out Europe. We're talking $25 trillion just to start. And it would then, if you were going to bail out the entirety of Europe, you would now be talking into the hundreds of trillions of dollars. Okay, people, there isn't that much wealth or money on the surface of the earth. The total gross domestic product of the entire planet Earth, I think, is just under $70 trillion. And we're talking about in excess of $100 trillion to bail out Europe. This is now mathematically impossible. These people have so leveraged themselves and so leveraged these governments in these countries, giving their brain-dead citizenry free handouts and entitlements, that it is now mathematically impossible to save the paradigm. It's not a matter of if the global financial system is going to collapse. Oh, it's going to collapse. You better trust and understand that. It's just a matter of when. And these piddling little maneuvers that these people are making, that the Fed is doing, oh, we're going to give Europe some money. Okay, what I saw this morning, what the Fed is getting ready to do in terms of Europe is going to keep Europe going for another 7 days. Well, fantastic. Thanks for that. And that's literally the brain dead mindset of these politicians. All they're doing is looking to kick the can down the road. At first, it was kick the can down another 10, 12 years. Then it's kick the can down the road for another year. And then it was, well, let's kick the can down the road for another few months. Now we're literally to the point where all we can do is kick the can down the road for a matter of a few days. It's not going to make it. I'll be very surprised if we make it to Christmas.
You know, one would have thought, Anne, after the 30 to 40 to 1 leverage leading up to the financial crisis of 2008, pre-Lehman, that financial firms would have learned, and especially a guy like John Corzine that saw Goldman have exposure to AIG with $13 billion of credit default swaps, which we bailed them out 100 cents on the dollar. Apparently, this lesson was not learned at MF Global, because what was the leverage? I think it was a figure like 100 to 1. It was just astounding.
Okay, I need you to understand what that means right there. Prior to 1929, you know, the roaring 20s, you could do no wrong. Literally, people could scrape together $25 and they could bet it on the market and it would go up 100 to 1. They'd have $2,500 at the end of a couple of weeks of investment. And then they would then margin that money. In other words, you take $2,500 and you margin $2.5 million worth of stock. Yeah, exactly. Then the $2.5 million worth of stock, let's say it doubles in value to $5 million. You just made money not on 2,500. You made money on 2.5 million. Yeah. And then all you really had to do was sell out, and you ended up with all that cash. People could do no wrong. Any stupid investment. I mean, this was a dot-com bubble like nothing the world has ever seen. Well, all that ended in 1929. People were margined out 50, 60, 70, even 100%. They were margined out on top of the cash that they had in the bank. Well, when the stock market fell, what happens is the Securities and Exchange Commission asks for a call. That is to say, by the way, the price went down on that, so now you have to buy the 2.5 million in stock because it didn't go up, it went down. So now you have to buy it. Well, you only have $2,500. You're broke. You're bankrupt overnight. And what happened was people who started with a few hundred dollars had mushroomed it in a couple of years to a few hundred thousand dollars. They were on top of the world until it crashed. And then they jumped out of windows. They committed suicide because what they saw happen was one day they were millionaires and the next day they're working on a farm for 25 cents a day. And their wives and their kids couldn't take it. And so through the stress, they jumped out of the windows by the dozens. It was terrible. Well, we're there again, only now it's not just a few investors. It's a planet. Everyone, every bank, every financial organization is leveraged out there as far as it can go. You heard Ann say the global wealth is somewhere around $70 trillion. Europe is over $100 trillion in debt. Just to bail it out, just to bring it to zero, where it can start growing again, is more money than exists on the planet. Now you see how the mathematics and the science of this works out. I'm going to play the rest of this for you. I'll intercede and explain things to you as we go along. Here we go.
It's astounding.
The only lesson that these criminal degenerates learned from the 2008 situation was that they could do anything they want and that pimp daddy government would bail them out. You have to understand, people like John Corzine, these are evil, evil people. He went into MF Global looking to rape that company personally for his own good. And that's what the motivation of a lot of these people are. You have to get your heads around this. You have to get your heads around the fact that there are truly evil people in the world who do not give a crap about anyone or anything except themselves, their own personal wealth, and their own personal power. And they would sell their grandmother to the Nazis for a nickel without hesitation if they thought they could get away with it. It's the same with people like John Corzine, and then we've talked about the fact that John Corzine is tied into the Obama regime, and we now know that the government is absolutely stuffed to the gills almost exclusively with this same type of moral degenerate culture. These people that are in the government, not just the Congress and the executive branch, but also in the bureaucracy, they're in it for themselves. They're in it for the money. And 2 weeks ago when we had the 60 Minutes expose on the insider trading, those of us who have been in the business have known intuitively that that was going on for a very, very long time. We knew that there was front running going on by politicians. A great example of this is someone like Harry Reid. Harry Reid, when he entered Congress, had a low six-figure net worth. He now has an eight-figure net worth, and he's never done anything except be a United States senator, the salary, I think, of which is something like $170,000 a year. How does that happen? How does a man with a $170,000 a year salaried position go from having a six-figure net worth to an eight-figure net worth? That doesn't make any sense unless he's doing nefarious, illegal, insider trading type deals. It's obvious what's been going on. You have to start acknowledging these people for what they are, and that is moral degenerates who are basically sociopaths and psychopaths, meaning they don't feel any sympathy or empathy for other human beings. The only thing they care about is themselves. They will do anything. They will steal. They will lie. They will cheat. They'll lie to your face. They'll look in a camera with this tremendous earnestness and lie with forked tongues through their teeth in order to advance their wealth and power. And if we as a people don't get real about this, if we keep having these Pollyanna visions that these people are all on our side and they're really looking out for us and they're doing the best they can, we will be corkscrewed into the ground and this nation will be reduced to a smoldering rubble. You've got to wake up.
You know, there's something even worse as you look into it. It's been hinted and that there could be possible clawbacks regarding MF Global. I wonder if you might explain that possibility and what a clawback means for, let's say you had an account at MF Global and, I don't know, you didn't feel comfortable with the commodities market, the volatility, you pulled your money out, there's a possibility they can go after you.
Oh, absolutely. Clawback is a fairly common tactic in bankruptcies. And what it is it's looking at the bankrupt entity and looking at the money that went out of that entity in the time period immediately preceding the collapse. And I don't know what time frame they would look at MF. I don't know if it would be 30 days or 60 days or 90 days. I have no idea. But the trustee has in the last 2 weeks said that, yes, clawback is on the table. So what that means is, let's say, for example, you're a savvy individual and you're a good steward of your money and you're doing business with a firm that clears through MF Global. You're looking at MF Global's publicly available bond yields, and you see in the 6 weeks before the collapse that their bond yields spiked parabolically. They went from 6% to 18%. That is a sure sign of massive trouble. And so being an intelligent, informed, aware person who is a good steward of their wealth, what do? You say, I'm getting out of this company. I'm getting my money out of MF Global because something bad is about to happen looking at these bond yields. You could also do the same thing looking at the stock price. You could do the same thing looking at downgrades by the ratings agencies. There's all kinds of ways that you could come to these conclusions. The other thing is if you're a hedger. If you're a bona fide hedger, if you have positions on and the market moves in favor of your hedge position on the futures side, you don't leave that equity sitting in your account. What your broker, like me, does is they wire that money home because you're using that money probably to either offset a cash transaction or to pay down a revolving line of credit. You're not getting any interest on your money sitting in MF Global, so you might as well get that equity out of there, send it home, and pay down your line of credit so you're not paying interest on that money. Okay, so there would organically have been lots and lots of money flowing out of that company in the period immediately before the collapse, either due to natural hedge, organic in and out functions, or due to intelligent people looking at the bond yields and saying, uh-oh, we better get out of here. The bankruptcy trustee can legally claw that money back. Say, okay, I'm going to go and I'm going to dive into your pocket now, and I'm going to claw back your money, which you, in your responsibility and in your good stewardship, pulled out of a company that you knew to be in trouble. Oh, yeah. So these MF customers, they will essentially be raped three times. They will have their cash stolen out of their accounts. They were then locked out of their positions so that they couldn't trade and were fully exposed to market risk, paralyzed, unable to do anything for an excess of a week. And then number three rape is having the bankruptcy trustee come back and literally seize money out of your own personal checking accounts and business accounts and so forth and clawing it back to feed this bankrupt entity. And you know what the cherry on top of the sundae of all this is? And this is what blows my mind. The bankruptcy trustee right now, as this is being recorded on the 30th of November, the bankruptcy trustee is still allowing MF Global to trade proprietarily for itself, for the company proper. It's unbelievable. Wow. The rule of law is dead in this country.
You know, adding to this, just prior to that, was the restructuring of Greek debt, where the Derivatives Association announced that it was a voluntary restructuring, so therefore the bankers didn't have to pay out on credit default swaps. So what you have here, Anne, I believe, is a system where the government is protecting the too big to fail at the expense of the customers, and with it, the rule of law is thrown out to protect Wall Street. What does that say about the integrity of the system? It's no wonder people are losing faith.
There is no integrity in the system. And let's make it simple. It's not just about the government protecting the quote-unquote too big to fail banks. It's about criminal oligarchs as individuals protecting each other. They don't give a crap about the customers of J.P. Morgan or, you know, Citi or Goldman or anything. What they care about is each other. Okay, the Obama regime is protecting John Corzine proper, the individual, because he is one of them. He is one of these criminal oligarchs. And for those of your listeners who may not remember, John Corzine is a former congressman. But immediately preceding MF Global, he was the governor of New Jersey, and he just corkscrewed Jersey into the ground. And it's Chris Christie who beat John Corzine to become the governor of New Jersey. Because, okay, so yes, this Republican, Chris Christie, was elected in New Jersey, uber liberal blue state New Jersey, because Corzine financially destroyed that state. And again, this guy is, of Corzine, is former head of Goldman. He's not stupid. You have to stop thinking that these people are just misguided or that there's some sort of a difference of opinion on economic theory. These people are nefariously trying to destroy everything in this country. It's called the Cloward-Piven strategy. Go in and destroy and collapse the entire economy, everything, and then rebuild a new, basically, Marxist socialist fascist state out of the burning rubble of this destruction. This is intentional. This is
the alchemy that we explained very clearly would happen right before 2012 in volume 2 of the Ark of Millions of Years, in the chapter called The Watchers. This is exactly, almost line for line, just the names are different. This guidance is coming from an ancient plan that has been in place for hundreds of years, very, very carefully, to take over the entire planet. And now you see what the plan is.
This is intentional. This is nefarious. This is not a function of incompetence. It's a function of malice aforethought and conscientious theft and destruction.
What would you advise? I'm a long-term believer in the bull market and commodities, but how do you play commodities when the futures market is no longer secure? And what does this do to the proper functioning of the markets? In other words, now that you've closed your firm because you don't believe in the integrity of the system, and we've just listed a series of reasons why, not honoring contracts, appropriating funds, not allowing trades to go off, and not one investigation. In fact, this goes even further than that. We had Bill Black, who was involved in the SNL scandal, and the SNL scandal, 2,000 individuals went to jail. There has not been one criminal charge brought by the Justice Department since the 2008 crisis.
Oh, now, would this be the same Justice Department that is involved in Fast and Furious? Is this the same Justice Department that has been grilled by Congress for the last couple of weeks? And everyone can just say, I don't recall. I'm not exactly clear. I don't remember writing that memo. I don't remember reading that. I don't remember getting that email, sir. Not one single solitary indictment. Not one. There were 2,000 in the SNL scandal. In Enron, there were more. Not one. Who is protecting who? Now, what you're about to hear may set you in a mode of panic. I really wrestled with playing it and not playing it because I wonder about my responsibility here. But at the end of the day, I don't have that many listeners, maybe a few thousand around the world, and maybe a few more than that will hear on BBS radio. And I feel that you need to be informed. You need to be empowered so that you can take care of yourselves without putting your family at risk. Because right now, as you've heard over the last 42 minutes or so, or 32 minutes, you're at risk. So I will play Ann's comments here. What you do is up to you. I didn't say it. She said it. She is a financial expert, a mathematician, a forecaster, a studier of the science and mathematics of investment. This is her advice, and you take it for what it's worth.
So given that this is where we are, what do you advise, and what will you do personally?
Well, get the hell out. Get out of all paper, and it's not just the commodities markets. This is going to cascade through everything. It's going to get into the equities. It's going to get into 401ks and IRAs. It's going to get into pension plans and so on and so forth. Total systemic collapse. Get out. I don't know how I can be any more plain about this. I say this over and over and over again, and then I get scads of emails saying, well, I can't get out of my 401k. Yes, you can. Yes, you can. Take the penalty and get the hell out of there. What would you rather do? Would you rather pay the 10% penalty, or would you rather have it all go up in smoke? Because that's what we're staring down the barrel of. Number two, we seem to have this backwards. In terms of what I do, cattle and grain specifically, the futures markets are the derivative. The futures markets are derived from the actual cash commodity markets. Now, I'm blessed because my area of expertise is actually in the physical cash markets, actual cattle on the hoof. So I have a consulting firm, and I'll continue to teach cattlemen how to trade actual physical cattle. But yeah, to all the people out there listening, you're going to have to get away from paper and get back into physical commodities, the real deal. Anything that's on paper, anything that involves a promise or a commitment is no longer valid because, as we've said, there isn't a rule of law anymore. People can steal from you. Your money can be confiscated. And think how easy now it is to confiscate people's wealth. Most of our wealth in this society exists as zeros and ones on a computer server. It takes no effort whatsoever to steal zeros and ones on a computer server. So what I've been telling people is you need to get into physical commodities. And the rule of thumb is that if you can stand in front of it with an assault rifle and physically protect it, then it's real. It's a real commodity. That includes food. That includes water. That includes long guns and ammunition. That includes fuel. That includes precious metals, gold and silver coinage, most especially silver coinage, because silver is the metal of barter and transaction and currency. Gold is the storage metal because it's so valuable per ounce. And also silver is extremely undervalued relative to gold because that market has been synthetically suppressed for the last several years by, again, these nefarious actors. So, yeah, reallocate into physical commodities.
How do you know that somebody like, just as we saw in 2008 or recently with MF Global, that somebody like a Goldman, a JP Morgan, which was writing credit default swaps on European debt, how do you know if you have an account with this group that they pledge your assets for collateral or they commingle them with the firm's assets? And then what do you do?
Oh, exactly. Corzine isn't alone in this. The reason the MF Global situation happened the way it did is, as we alluded to earlier, because Corzine had that company just suicidally leveraged. He took those customer funds and then leveraged it into European sovereign junk paper at about 100-to-1 ratio. Okay, massive, massive leverage. That's why his collateral call was the first one to come and why it took him out, because he was so heavily leveraged. Don't kid yourself. These other entities are doing the same thing. It's just that they're not as heavily leveraged as Corzine was. So, yes, the entire paradigm is no longer trustworthy. There is no meaningful government or industry-wide regulation, and I've been saying this for years, that regulation in the financial industry in the United States, both government-based and private regulation, private industry regulation, is a monstrous, monstrous joke. The top tier of those organizations are evil, nefarious people. The mid-level are halfway stupid, halfway evil, who, again, are just there to collect their salary paycheck and will say and do anything that they're told, and who really don't understand the business that they're trying to regulate. And then the lower level, the grunts, the actual auditors who go out on site, a lot of those people are super incompetent, affirmative action hires, and yes, I said it, and I'm not ashamed of it. They are affirmative action hires. They have no business being there doing what they're doing. They're also hiring a lot of kids. 15 minutes out of college who literally are reading off a script and couldn't audit a company if their life depended on it. And so what they do is they send these incompetent people out into the field and into lower management, and then when the poop hits the fan, they blame them. It's absolutely evil, and it's a complete joke. And Madoff was the first proof of that. There have been other Ponzi schemes since Madoff happened that haven't gotten as much notoriety, but there was a big one in the futures industry that all of the FCMs were invested in. And the regulatory body of the futures industry, the NFA, they audited that Ponzi scheme. They totally missed it. They even admitted that they signed off on it because they really didn't understand what they were doing. I mean, that's the level of incompetence and evil that we're talking about in terms of these regulatory bodies. The only way to fix this is to shut the whole damn thing down and start from scratch. And I'm personally looking within the next decade for the emergence of a new exchange in the United States. Word on the street is that it might happen in Dallas, and I'd be fully in favor of that. Start over from scratch.
All right. Well, the message, get physical and protect yourself.
Well, there you have it. Now, do I advocate all of that? I have been saying for the last year, very slowly, very carefully, not in a brash way, carefully, move your cash out of the banks. Get it out of the banks and get it in your hands. Convert it into something that you think has value, food, property, precious metals, if that's where you want to put it, water or the ability to filter water. And it's not so much the end of the world. It's the end of the financial structure. I have been telling you for quite some time that the Securities and Exchange Commission chairman has allowed lawbreaking on an unbelievable scale. Now you have the testimony of one of the financial experts herself. That was Ann Barnhart. Take it for what it is or don't. But the choice is up to you. Now you're fully informed. Let's take a quick break a little after the gold rush, the Alice Band. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Robin Knight's in armor come saying something about a queen. There were peasants singing and drummers drumming, and the archer split the tree. There was a fanfare blowing to the sun that was floating on the breeze. Looking Mother Nature on the run in the 21st century. Well, I was lying in a burned-up basement with the full moon in my eyes. I was hoping for a replacement when the sun burst through the sky. There was a band playing in my head, and I felt like getting high. I was thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Well, I dreamed I saw the silver spaceship flying in the yellow haze of the sun. There were children crying and colors flying all around the chosen one. All in a dream, all in a dream, the loading had begun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun.
And welcome back to X Squared Radio, the Alice Band after the Gold Rush, originally written by Neil Young. Great song, great song. We love Love the Alice Band. They do a wonderful job here at X Squared Radio. I wanted to make sure that you know how to become part of the program tonight if you want to. That was a very, very powerful segment. You can loosen your seatbelts now just a little bit. If you want to be a part of the program, it's 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471, anywhere in North America, toll-free. And if you're anywhere else on planet or off planet, if you can reach a cell phone tower, you can get to us. It's 530-413-4511. Now, you know, we've tried, you know, in the last couple of months to talk about the sociology of the Occupy movement. It is sort of a headless, faceless movement of energy, the likes of which, you know, most politicians and activists and activist organizations would be envious of, the energy, the passion, the commitment to go out in the winter and to brave the baton and the pepper spray. This is the level of commitment that any organization would like to see in its followers, in its activists, in its protesters. The right to protest is something that we here in this country have always valued, whether it was in 1968 Democratic Convention, or whether it is the Democratic Convention in 2012 in Charlotte, North Carolina. Believe me, the organizers of this convention do not want to see a repeat of what happened in 1968 happen in Charlotte, North Carolina, and there are some precautions being taken to keep that from happening. Will they be able to keep it from happening? I don't believe so. I don't believe so. I think that as much as law enforcement tries to resist this movement, it will just embolden them. Now they have financial experts, as we just had in the last hour, speak about the truth and the motivation, the subterfuge, the falsehood, the motivation, and the perpetration of this alchemical process of taking over the world unfold before us. This is what we're seeing. This is a plan. It is not random. We're not talking about a bunch of, you know, selfish guys just grabbing everything that they get. No. It's well coordinated. Because if it was just a bunch of selfish guys, you'd have some law enforcement out there. You'd have some chairman, some auditor. Somebody would be ringing the bell and shining the light and busting the doors down. You'd have, you know, an Elliot Ness somewhere in the CIA and the FBI and the, you know, the Department of Justice. Somebody would go after them. But nothing is happening because the corruption and the plan is so well laid that the head of the Justice Department is now bought and paid for with this whole Fast and Furious thing. There are individuals in the Department of Justice that should serve the rest of their lives in prison, charged with conspiracy, murder, you name it, gun running. Illegal gun running into a foreign country. They could stand charges in Mexico, but now they're being shielded. They're being protected by a system that now owns them. And by the way, don't you dare prosecute John Corzine and his people. Because if you do, we might start leaking memos of what you did know and when you did know it on Fast and Furious, and you'll go to jail. You won't just lose your job. You'll lose everything you ever had in your whole life. We own you now. And you can see it in their eyes when they sit at the table at Congress. They know what to say. They know, I don't recall. They know, I'm not clear on that. They know, I don't remember reading that. You know, I get a lot of emails throughout the day. I don't read them all. I maybe scan them. I was not aware. I didn't know. I wasn't aware. I read about it in the paper with you guys. One lie after another after another. And let's not even get into the Securities and Exchange Commission. My gosh, that is corrupt from top to bottom now, I'm convinced. So what do you do? How do you prepare? Where do you go? What do you do? Well, with this movement that's out there, I have made the suggestion that they need to put names and faces on these signs and get it out there. You need to ask for the resignation of these individuals by name. You need to get their names out in the press, because these are not public people. These are not people that are used to being in the press. These are the behind-the-scenes people. These are the people, you know, inside the bureaucracy. They're not the public figures. They're not elected by you. So the political science of how this works is that you must have a system that has no chinks in the armor. And that way the leader, or at least the person that's appearing to be the leader, can relax. He can say whatever he wants. You look at the approval numbers and look at the statistics of these approval numbers, 42%, 43%, 44%. They said that no president has ever been reelected with a 44% approval rating. Nonsense. That's not true at all. Clinton was elected twice with 43% of the vote. Twice with 43% of the vote. Why? Because his opponent was two people. That's right. His opponent was two different candidates in two different parties, and they divided up the vote. And each of those pieces was smaller than 43%. And he won twice. Now, I don't know if that's going to happen this time. We look at the political science of it. We look at Ron Paul. He's running as a Republican, not an independent, not a libertarian. We know that a libertarian cannot win a major office. We already know that from history. We know people will not vote that way. But we also know, as the candidates get closer and closer, that Ron Paul is elevating the notoriety and the legitimacy of a third party, which means a third party, and they always do, at least one or two, will run. And when they run, they're going to siphon off some of that vote. 5%, 5.5%, 6%. Now you've got something that works. If Obama pulls 44% of the vote and his opponent pulls 43% of the vote and somebody out there pulls 13% of the vote, Obama's going to win. And as I have already told you, you're about to be bombarded with between $200 and $300 million worth of propaganda in the next 12 months. I'm asking you to hold up. Hold up against it, because you know what to do, and have confidence that there are other people that know what to do as well. Never before has there been this surge, this underground surge of energy. And this underground surge of energy does not have a spokesperson. In fact, they feign a spokesperson. They are a body of energy, and they're anonymous and uncontrollable. And you know how it is when you have something like that. You don't have a face. You don't have a name. You can't discredit it. You can go after the mass, but you can't go after an individual. You can't go after a Mr. Jones. You can't go after a Branch Davidian. You can't go after the person and tear them apart, because it's not a person. It's a mass of people. And it's in every major city in the country. And when this spring happens in this country, the demonstrations that you've seen in Russia recently with 60 and 70,000 people at them in Russia protesting their elections, that's nothing compared to what you will see in this country. What Anne was talking about was a revolution. What Anne was talking about was a civil war. That is a people's war. And in this war, we have a much more effective weapon than in any country in any time in history. We have the ability to vote. You can go to the polls and you can vote. And you can take people like Harry Reid and others out of office. Simple, simple. Just throw them out of office. That's all you have to do. Everybody that has three or more terms, get rid of them. Get rid of them. I don't think Congress or the Senate would stumble one bit. There's plenty of ways to learn how to do that job. We don't need people that have been in there 18 to 24 years. Three terms and you're out. I don't care how smart you are. There are other smart people. It's too corrupt. Harry Reid comes in with $170,000 a year salary and ends up with a multi-tens of millions net worth. It doesn't happen, people. You don't get that lucky. You're doing insider trading. You're passing regulations. You're selling influence. Is it legal? Maybe. Is it ethical? No. All right. The Taiwan spy agency denies a magnetic attack. Now, we've heard about that from time to time, various conspiracy theories, scalar weapons, magnetic weapons. But this is actually in the press. A Taiwan spy agency denies magnetic attack. Taiwan's intelligence agency on Tuesday flatly rejected publicly allegations that it had launched an electromagnetic wave attack against the running mate of an opposition presidential candidate. Can you believe it? The National Security Bureau has not owned the alleged technologies, nor have we used equipment to harass the alleged targeted person, the Bureau said in a statement. I'm sorry, my BS detector is in full bloom right there. Lin Ruey Xiong, the running mate of independent candidate James Sung, surprised the public last week when he claimed to have been subjected to electromagnetic wave attacks by the Bureau on September 20th outside his home and over the following 3 days. If I hadn't quickly moved out of my home, I would have lost my mind, he told reporters. Lin, an epidemiologist, was chosen by Sung as his running mate in a move seen as aimed at securing support from Taiwan's rich and influential medical circles. Sung is considered unlikely to win in the January 14 polls, but observers said he could threaten the incumbent Ma Ying-jeou, who is locked in a tight race against Tsai Ing-wen on the main opposition Democratic Progressive Party. So it's just interesting. You know, when you see somebody come forward and say, we deny using, you know, flux capacitors, you can almost be assured they're using flux capacitors and backup flux capacitors. When another nation says that the U.S. is bombing their beaches or bombing their roads, and we say, hey, we're not doing that. We don't have anything to do with that. It's probably because we're shipping the weapons to somebody in Jordan who's actually conducting the bombing, and it just looks like we're not doing it, but we are. So I always have a tendency to put a little more credence into these press releases. You know, it's not so much that they're, tabloids or, you know, the National Enquirer or the Star or something like that. Unlike, you know, Men in Black, this is the place to get your most reliable information on aliens on the Earth. They wouldn't run the story if there wasn't some credence to it, because most newspapers, especially self-respecting, political magazines, won't run something they don't have at least some source to back it up. So it's just interesting that in Taiwan they might be using electromagnetic wave, you know, weaponry, let's call it. Let's just call it what it is, against their opponents to drive them edgy or maybe make their memory falter during a debate, or make them have a blank out in the middle of a debate or an interview. It's kind of strange when you watch, you expect that from a candidate every now and then. But we've had, three Republican primary candidates during debates or during news interviews go, what is that name? I came here prepared, I promise. I just can't recall the name right now. Come on, people. Use your heads. We don't just have 9 stupid Republican candidates up there running for the primary president of the United States. Do you think something like this is going on in this country? You think somebody's aiming weapons at one or more of these candidates, giving them these brain farts in the middle of these interviews? Come on, I just read you the newspaper here where one of the candidates is claiming, I'm sorry, people, I know this. I'm an epidemiologist. I'm being bombarded with electromagnetic wave radiation. Serious stuff. In science news, massive black holes are larger than expected. Now, research suggests black holes in two nearby galaxies are even bigger. You know from Volume 1 of The Arc of Millions of Years, where we published that inside every single galaxy is a spinning black hole, a supermassive spinning black hole that creates a kind of planar energy because these black holes are spinning at their maximum speed. Literally, a conservation of momentum requires them to spin at those speeds. When they spin, these supermassive spinning black holes flatten out like a dinner plate, and then along that galactic plane of gravity, all the stars line up. In fact, it has been often said on this program that black holes may be the light engine, the engine of energy that lights up the stars in that galaxy. Well, we had ideas based on the size of galaxy and their rotational forces and, you know, the best theories that we had at the time that, black holes can only be so large. Well, the interesting thing is that these have turned out to be much larger than expected. Scientists use the Gemini and Keck observatories in Hawaii and the McDonald Observatory in Texas to monitor the velocities of stars orbiting around the centers of a pair of galaxies. These velocities reveal the strength of the gravitational pull on those stars, which in turn is linked with the masses of the black holes lurking there. We can't actually directly observe the black hole, but we can make a relation of how much gravity is in that black hole, and from that determine its mass based on the stuff we can see that's flying around the outside of these black holes in these galactic, in these gravitational orbits. And some of these stars are revolving at incredible speeds, you know, tens of thousands of kilometers per second. Well, the black hole is at the center and is surrounded by stars in these galaxies, and these stars are going along at very high velocity. And the interesting thing is that the stars on the very outside of the galaxy are going at the same velocity. The black hole is 7 times larger than Pluto's orbit. You understand what that means? The black hole is 7 times larger than the furthest out planet in our solar system, the orbit of it. In other words, every single planet and the sun is inside of Pluto's orbit, and we don't take up hardly any space at all. These black holes are 7 times larger than that. The new findings suggest that one galaxy known as NGC 3842, the brightest galaxy in the LEO cluster of galaxies, nearly 320 million light years distant, has a central black hole 9.7 billion solar masses large. That's right. 9.7 billion of our suns crammed into the singularity of that black hole. The other, named NGC 4889, the brightest galaxy in the Coma cluster, more than 335 million light years away, has a black hole of comparable or larger mass. Both encompass regions or event horizons about 5 times the distance from the Sun to Pluto. For comparison, these black holes are 2,500 times as massive as the black hole as at the center of the Milky Way galaxy, whose event horizon is 1/5 the orbit of Mercury. And study lead author Nicholas McConnell at the University of California, Berkeley, has backed all of this up. The scientists used the Gemini and Keck observatories in Hawaii and McDonald Observatory in Texas, and they monitored the velocity of these stars, and that's how they came up with the information. So black holes are much, much larger than what we thought they were. The researchers suggest these relatively dim black holes may be the aged remnants of quasars. Their central black holes are no hang on a second. Let me just back up a little bit because there's some information that I wanted to feed you. Yeah, these. This is Nicholas McConnell at the University of California, Berkeley. These two new supermassive black holes are similar in mass to young quasars. You know, quasars are the largest structures in the universe, and may be the missing link between quasars and the supermassive black holes we see today. A quasar has an electrojet that is high-velocity particles that are launched out of the north and south poles of large supermassive spinning black holes. And these jets create a very, very bright signature out there in space. The researchers suggest these relatively dim black holes may be the aged remnants of quasars. Their central black holes are no longer fed by accreting gas, so have become dormant and hidden. The boisterous quasars may have passed through a turbulent youth to become quiescent giant elliptical galaxies. The pair of black holes is 1.6 to 4.6 times more massive than one would predict from their galaxies, based on details such as the brightness of the bulges at their centers. These findings suggest that black holes may grow differently in large galaxies than in small ones. So, you know, we're learning a little bit more each year as we study these and learn more about black holes. And, of course, we have the LIGOs, the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatories, which are now just finishing their refit from last year. And it's about $10 to $12 million a year to complete these refits at these facilities. One is in Hanover, Washington, which is way out by the old nuclear power plant that's now closed down. And the other is in Livingston, Louisiana, which is the older of the two facilities. And I've been to both facilities and been through them. And it's quite fascinating to see interferometers this size. It just boggles the mind to stand there and see a tunnel on top of the ground, a concrete tube that it goes so far away from you that it goes over the horizon. It's literally beyond what you can see standing on the ground. You have to be in the air to see it. Mr. Mai, who works at one of the facilities, say, we know that bigger galaxies are made by mergers of smaller galaxies. And during this process, the black holes at the center of the smaller galaxies can merge to form bigger black holes, Mai said. But black holes can also grow by being fed by gas in their vicinity. It's a bit like asking, you know, are taller children produced by taller parents or by eating a lot of spinach? For black holes, we're just not sure. It's probably the spinach, Mai. Also in the space news, and you may have heard this. I don't know if you're out there reading and listening about it. NASA's Voyager 1 is now beginning to leave the solar system and enter the Milky Way. It's entering a new region of space between the solar system and interstellar space, in what NASA has described as a cosmic purgatory. Now, there are theories about what exists out there, and, you know, lots of scientific pundits have somewhat put their careers on the line by saying, I know what's out there beyond the outer rim, beyond the edge of the heliosphere. When these Voyagers pop out in the cold blackness of space, there should be nothing more than a mild microwave hum left over from the original Big Bang of the universe. And not a few scientists have put their eggs in that basket. I am not an astrophysicist, but I have thought about it from time to time. And I, just to be contrary, have said, you know, quite the opposite, that there are magnetic organizations of energy out there in space. And it's quite possible, quite probable, that Voyager will run into them and discover them. The spacecraft is close to leaving the solar system and into the uncharted territory of the Milky Way after more than three decades in space. Voyager 1 was launched with its twin, Voyager 2, by the U.S. National Aeronautics and Space Administration in 1977, 5 years after the Apollo missions were terminated. That's a long time ago. Yeah, we were just, you know, understanding what computers were and how they could function in 1977. I don't think the 8088 processor was even on the market then. Voyager 1 is traveling at just under 11 miles per second and sending information from nearly 11 billion miles away from the sun. It is about to become the first man-made object to leave the solar system, although NASA experts expect it to take between several months and years before it completely enters interstellar space. Voyager 2 will follow later. Ed Stone, the Voyager project scientist at the California Institute of Technology, Caltech, in Pasadena, it's right there pretty close to Pasadena City College where I attended, Voyager tells us now that we're in a stagnation region in the outermost layer of the bubble around our solar system. Voyager is showing that what is outside is pushing back. We shouldn't have long to wait to find out what the space between stars is really like. The primary mission for these spacecrafts was the exploration of Jupiter and Saturn. But it was so successful, and it slingshotted off of those planets. It just kept going and going and going. And like, you know, the proverbial Energizer bunny, it's out there still running and still sending messages home. And now we're beginning to understand, or just beginning to get measurements of what interstellar space really is. Is it really the void of absolute zero out there between stars, or is there available energy and indeed organized pockets of high energy and high magnetic bubbles, as it were? After uncovering important findings, the mission was extended, with the radio contact with mission control lasting longer than had been expected. You know, sometimes we build stuff that holds together longer than we expect. And NASA typically over-engineers things, as is evident by the rovers that ran around on Mars a couple years after they were expected to last. Spirit has gone the way of the world, but Opportunity is still running. And now we have launched Curiosity, which is a much larger, faster, and more agile probe, and it should be landing on Mars in about 3 months. Rob Decker, a Voyager low-energy charged particle instrument co-investigator — how would you like to have that on your name tag? Hey, Rob, what do you do at work? Oh, I'm a low-energy charged particle instrument co-investigator from Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Laboratory. He says, we've been using the flow of energetic charged particles at Voyager 1 as a kind of windsock to estimate the solar wind velocity. We found that the wind speeds are low in this region and gust erratically. For the first time, the wind even blows back at us. We are evidently traveling in completely new territory. Scientists had suggested previously that there might be a stagnation layer, but we weren't sure it existed until now. Voyager 1 and 2 both hold a gold-coated copper phonograph record. You know, just in case they kind of get picked up by someone else. Someone could play that record and, well, hear the voices of our presidents in various speeches and a little bit of our history and music. And there's also a record that contains over 100 photographs of Earth, a selection of greetings from languages around the world, and a variety of sounds from the Earth. I wonder if one of them is a small block Chevy. Well, I'm just asking. Carl Sagan and Ann Druyan wrote in an introduction to a CD version of the record that billion years from now, when everything on Earth we've ever made has crumbled into dust, when the continents have changed beyond recognition and our species is unimaginably altered or extinct, the Voyager record will speak for us. I think, that's been done a couple of times on this planet. You know, long after our civilization is gone and our zenith has passed away and we have scattered across the face of the earth, the stone legacy that we've built talking about this rendezvous with a certain spot in the galaxy on December 21st, 2012, this will still be here. People will still know who we were, what we did, what we believed. And if they can figure out the engineering of what we put together, they'll know where we're from, or even more interestingly, where we went. By the way, if you want to be part of that, and I just can't imagine anything more exciting. I mean, what are you going to do? You going to sit around and watch football or something like that? Come on, people. Maya 2012. Go with me to Chichen Itza. Ground zero for this entire 2012 legacy that you've been hearing about for the last 10 years, that you've read about in the Ark of Millions of Years. Come with us. Go with us. You know who else is going to be down there? Sting, Carlos Santana. This is going to be an amazing 10 days. Come on. December 13th through the 22nd, you'll be home for Christmas, and you can tell your grandkids, guess where I was. You can do it. Click on the orange banner at xsquaredradio.com. Maya 2012. Go with me. These Voyagers have enough power and fuel to operate until at least 2020. It is predicted by that point that Voyager 1 will be 12.4 billion miles from the sun, while Voyager 2 will be 10.5 billion miles away. Just interesting stuff. Oh, also in the news, I would love to hear your opinion on this because, you know, there's just stuff people are missing here. I just know it, okay? Give me a call, toll-free 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471, or anywhere else on planet or off planet, 530-413-4511, 530-413-4511. And if you have to get out, and I don't suggest to do that tonight because live tonight is where you want to be. But if you have to get out, you can still listen to the program by dialing at 760-569-7676, 760-569-7676, and then put in the access code 192-919-POUND, 192-919-POUND. At least you'll be able to hear, which is important, because we're about to talk about stuff that has not been talked about on the news yet. I've heard just about everything that's been said about this next event, and I stay pretty close to it because it's so darn interesting. Just one of the mysteries of the Earth that just surprises me. It's like history repeating itself. Just interesting stuff. You have seen on the news already that they're one of our finest, most stealthy, sexy-looking drones crashed in Iran this last week on December 7th, 2011, a day that will live in infamy. Well, that's a whole nother story, too. I'd love to get into that if somebody wants to talk about that. But the drone really interests me. You know, don't you think that thing looks really cool, for one thing? I think the design of it is like, you know, it's something like right out of World War II. It just looks like a ME-163. It just looks very neat. But the thing that interested me is that it's flying 149 miles over the Iranian border. And that's interesting enough. It's flying at 2 miles high, roughly 11,000 feet. That's also pretty interesting. The thing that amazes me is that it landed intact. Now, come on, people. You know, Earth explorers, let's put our logic hat on here. Let's get out our Occam's razor. Go ahead and unsheath it, unfold it, you know, grab it out of your scabbard, and just wave it through the air a couple times because we're going to take a slice at a couple things we've heard in the press. First of all, the drone lands without damage, virtually undamaged, the RQ-170 Sentinel drone. How does that happen? Okay, for one thing, it didn't have a parachute. For another thing, this looks like it has at least 100 computers on the darn thing just to keep it stable. This is a fly-by-wire craft, right? It's linked to, I don't know, somewhere in Nevada, maybe some kid is flying. In fact, I think what I read on the research, there are only 22 people in the entire world that had to go through a couple years of very intensive training and understand the SQL language and the control language and the methodology and the encryption just to be able to fly this thing. There are only 22 people on the planet that can fly it. And I'm pretty sure they all work for us. So if this thing runs out of fuel or just, you know, all of a sudden, you know, like you drop a cell phone call, hey, I can't communicate with the drone anymore. I think some heads would roll right there. But this little thing had no safeguard. It didn't have a homing pigeon, you know, a little EEPROM. You know, an EEPROM is like a burned chip firmware. So it says, okay, as long as I have communication with home base, I will continue to receive information and fly by command. But as soon as the communication is lost, and I got to tell you, people, doing the failure mode and effects analysis, that's called the FEMA in our business, you have to sit down and you got to think about the failure modes, things that can go wrong. What can go wrong with this? I guarantee you, teams sat down for months and went line by line through this. And one of the things that definitely would come up, I think, in the first 10 or 12 what ifs or oh craps, what happens if we lose communication? I mean, come on, I dropped a cell phone call on the way to work today. It could happen. You know, we're in the middle of Afghanistan. We're in the middle of Iran. There's no cell phone towers out there that belong to us. There's no way something could fail with the communications. All right, that's our failure mode. We lose communication. Now what? Oh, it flies itself safely to the ground and lands on an Iranian runway, unharmed. Hello? Are you kidding me? Who brought that up? Leave the room. You with the two striper. Leave the room. That was so dumb. You're now ejected from this group. Come on, people. You lose communication, the EEPROM kicks in, it takes a GPS location of itself, and it flies itself home. It flies itself 149 miles back to friendly territory. Duh. Now, suppose it runs out of fuel. Well, it could happen. You know, I let time get by me. We didn't fill it up with fuel. I was flying faster than normal. I used too much fuel. We were trying to get back. I ran out of gas. We had headwinds. Okay, these are all failure modes. All right, I ran out of fuel. Something in that craft says, I've run out of fuel. My motor has stopped. What shall I do now? Oh, I think I'll glide safely to the ground on a runway somewhere in Iran. That's the wrong answer, too. Okay, I think I'll self-destruct. I know. A lot of you have made that suggestion. But they don't carry self-destruct mechanisms on these things. You know, they're out there doing surveillance. They don't have enough room to carry, you know, 6 or 7 pounds of C4 on them. So I think it would make sense to just nose the thing straight into the ground and land at about 400 miles an hour and just plow this thing into a million bits. Although, I have to admit, even the million bits, they could learn a lot of information. And the other thing that some of you have suggested, and I think this is pretty smart, is that as stealthy as it was being flown by remote control. And that the remote control signal was received and was hacked and it was taken over. Yeah, that somebody with a joystick grabbed this craft in Iran and flew it to the ground and landed it. But didn't I just say 10 minutes ago that only 22 people on the planet even knew how to fly this thing? Yes, I did. And I was almost 100% sure that all 22 of those people have top secret ratings, and I'm almost 100% sure they all work for us. So how did that happen? And I listened to the really arrogant news reporting by the military. Okay, yeah, the Iranians have it, but they don't really understand what they have. They will never be able to figure out what this thing is capable of doing. We're not really worried because it has a lot of secrets and they're just not really up to snuff. They'll walk around and say, look what a neat used car we have. Come on. Somebody grabbed that thing. Until this week, the high-altitude flights from bases in Afghanistan were among the most secret of many intelligence collection efforts against Iran. By the way, flying into sovereign airspace, spying, can be seen as an act of war. and American officials refused to discuss it. But the crash of the vehicle, I would really, that's a stretch, come on. The safe landing of the unharmed vehicle. Yeah, there we go. I like that a lot better. The safe landing of the unharmed vehicle, which Iranian officials said occurred more than 140 miles from the border with Afghanistan, blew the program's cover. The overflights by the bat-winged RQ-170 Sentinel, built by Lockheed Martin, and first glimpsed on an airfield in Kandahar, Afghanistan in 2009, are part of an increasingly aggressive intelligence collection program aimed at Iran, current and former officials say. The urgency of the effort has been underscored by a recent public debate in Israel about whether time is running out for a military strike to slow Iran's progress toward a nuclear weapon. In a recent speech, President Obama's national security advisor, Tom Donilon, hinted at secret efforts by the United States to keep watch on Iran's nuclear program. He quotes, he's quoted here by saying, "We will continue to be vigilant," he said last month at the Brookings Institution. "We will work aggressively to detect any new nuclear-related efforts by Iran. We will expose them and force Iran to place them under international inspections." Yeah. Iran said over the weekend that it had recovered the RQ-170, the same drone deployed over Osama bin Laden's compound before he was killed in May. Shot in the face, you remember. Senior intelligence officials were disturbed that the drone was publicly discussed in the coverage of bin Laden raid, in part because of the fear of exposing its use over Iran. A statement Sunday from the American-led International Security Assistance Force in Afghanistan said Iran might have recovered an unarmed reconnaissance aircraft lost while flying a mission over western Afghanistan. That was the original statement. But several experts noticed that the stealth technology of the RQ-170, which greatly reduces the chances that the drone can be detected by radar, had little use in western Afghanistan because the Taliban have no radar to detect flights. You don't need a stealthy craft if the Taliban have no radar. Iranian officials have said that the aircraft was detected near the town of Kashmar, 140 miles from the Afghan border. Let me read that again. Iranian officials have said that the aircraft was detected near the town of Kashmar, 140 miles from the Afghan border, and that it was shot down or crashed because its control systems were hacked by the Iranian military. American officials said that those stories are fanciful and that the drone was lost because of a malfunction. That's the most important paragraph in the entire article, Earth Explorers. Somewhere in between, its control systems were hacked by the Iranian military and the drone was lost because of a malfunction is the truth. Now, let's take a couple more swipes with Occam's razor here. In military history, at least in what is recorded as military history, there is often a tactic called the Trojan horse. You're familiar with this from the movie Troy, where a trophy of some kind is fashioned and marched up to the walls as a gift to the enemy. The enemy then unwittingly opens its gates, brings the trophy in, and closes the gates behind it, and then proceeds to have a drunken party. While everyone is sleeping the stupor off, the virus, the troops, those that would open the gate from the inside, slip out of the Trojan horse, open the gates, and in comes the army. In a previously unassailable fort, the enemy simply marches in and does what they do. In your opinion, do you think it's possible that the RQ-170 is a Trojan horse? Do you think that the surveillance equipment that's on that craft is right now recording information while it's in Iranian space, being hauled up and down the road on parade, being put on national television with the used car salesman walking around it going, and here we have nice smooth wings in a beautiful 2012 model RQ-170. Highest bidders, please. Uh-huh. Yeah, oh, I guarantee you, there's a Barrett Jackson going on over there right now. Absolutely. Chinese and Russians are bidding on this thing minute by minute, and Iran is having a ball. Somewhere in this thing is the truth. We're carving away at this thing. 888-429-5471. In your opinion, is the RQ-170 safely landing in Iranian on an Iranian, what, a road, a runway? You think it just landed on a rocky mountainous area, unharmed, not a scratch or a dent on it? Come on, people. Iran's not a completely flat area where you could just, you know, land in between the tumbleweeds. It's a rough country out there. If it's not excavated, if it's not bulldozed, if it's not, you know, fixed up or improved in some way, there's no place to land a craft like this. Somewhere in between Iranian military hacking this thing and flying it to the ground. Now, they may have not done a perfect landing. You notice that the landing gear is covered up in the picture they have on the press. But there's no dents on the thing. This thing didn't do an endo. It didn't do a cartwheel. It landed flat and level somewhere. Maybe the parachute didn't deploy. Maybe, you know, as I said, only 22 people in the world can fly it. But come on, all you got to be is a good Xbox user or PlayStation 3 user, and you should be able to land this thing. Heck, you got 11,000 feet to get the hang of it. American officials say those stories are fanciful. I'm sorry. My BS detector is in full flame on that one, and that the drone was lost because of a malfunction. Well, yeah, it might be a malfunction in design. My failure mode and effects analysis, if it was followed, there's no way that thing would have landed. Either way, the centerpiece of what had been a covert program is now definitely, irrefutably, in the hands of Iranian forces, which may share the captured technology with other countries. Oh, I would take that word may, which shall share the captured technology with other countries. There's a Barrett Jackson auction, a Craigslist eBay auction going on right now on the RQ-170. There are differing accounts of the extent of the damage to the craft. Iran has not published photographs of the wreckage. Take that back. They just showed it on the news tonight. Though officials have said video of the drone may soon be broadcast on television. This is an old article. That's how this thing has really blossomed in the last 5 days. Two officials said that the United States briefly considered going in to retrieve the downed drone or to destroy it. At first reported Wednesday by the Wall Street Journal, but the operation was deemed too risky. I reckon so. There are questions about whether Iran could reverse engineer the technology, though they certainly could sell the vehicle to China, Russia, or other countries with a deep interest in it. You know, the old tail from the helicopter left over from the hard landing that they had on the bin Laden raid that was of high interest to the Chinese, and their stealthy helicopters have come years and years ahead. And I guarantee you that if this drone has the technology that they're fearful it has on it, well, we might not be able to bring the troops home as soon as we thought. The flights from Moscow and Beijing to Tehran were probably quite full the last few days, said P.W. Singer, who studies military robotics at the Brookings Institution. Mr. Singer said that the most sought-after technology on the craft is probably its array of sensors, which may include sophisticated radar that is more advanced than anything Russia or China use currently. Dennis M. Gormley, a missile and drone expert at the University of Pittsburgh, said reverse engineering the aircraft itself would be difficult, even for a sophisticated military, unless somebody put the engineering drawings in the UAV. Ding, 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 ding. Oh, you think maybe it has a little slot in there with the owner's manual and all the codes and, you know, the engineering drawings actually in it? It won't be easy. In any complex piece of aviation equipment, you have to replicate the tolerances precisely. Yeah, well, I think you can get pretty close and you can understand a lot. In Abbottabad, Pakistan, the RQ-170 was used to model the Bin Laden compound. In Iran, among other missions, it is looking for tunnels, underground facilities, and other places where Iran could be building centrifuge parts or enrichment facilities. In other words, this thing might be equipped with a HAARP. Yeah, it might be equipped with a HAARP where it could actually see underground structures. One such site outside Qom was revealed by President Obama and the leaders of France and Britain in 2009, though it appears that Israel played a major role in detecting that site. One senior official said recently that we've got nothing of that scale yet, but added we are looking every day. Surveillance of Iran is nothing new. American satellites have been trained on its nuclear facilities, their missile bases, and their defense for many years, but the RQ-170 Sentinel, which can fly at an altitude of 50,000 feet, is considered vital to the effort. While an orbiting surveillance satellite can observe a location for only a few minutes at a time, a drone can loiter for hours, sending a video feed as people move about the site. Such a pattern of life, as it is called, can give crucial clues to the nature of the work being done there, the equipment used, and the size of the workforce. It's basically like staking out a mafia social club, said John Pike, who tracks military technology at the website globalsecurity.org. If I'm just looking at a brick-and-mortar targets, satellite's fine, but I want to see what people are doing all day. The drone is a whole lot better. In addition to video cameras, independent experts say the drone almost certainly carries communications intercept equipment and sensors that can detect tiny amounts of radioactive isotopes and other chemicals that can give away nuclear research. New reports in South Korea in 2009 and in the United States plan to base the RQ-170 drone there to fly surveillance missions over North Korea, whose nuclear and missile programs are a top American intelligence target. Well, I think it's just interesting, you know, that we have been flying the drones. Everybody knows that. But to have our most advanced, most sophisticated, most modern, most stealthy one land intact in Iran, well, we've taken three good shavings with our Occam's razor, and I'm not buying it. If that thing would have malfunctioned the way they think it did, that it just lost communications or lost its way, it would have crashed into a pile of aluminum foil. It should have had an EEPROM chip in it that when it loses communication, it heads home based on GPS settings inside the craft. If the engines quit and it stopped running altogether, that thing should have nosed itself down and gone straight into the ground at 200 or 300 miles an hour. End of story. I'm sorry. That thing was in Pakistan. It was probably hacked in Pakistan. When it took off, got over Iran, the codes to hack it were sent to Iran. Iran took over the control system and flew this thing to the ground. Now, maybe it wasn't the smoothest landing in the world, and that's why they have the landing gear covered up, but they landed it nonetheless. And if they can't reverse engineer it, the Chinese or Russians will be able to reverse engineer it. We lost a lot of ground on this. Somebody didn't think this through. I'm not exactly sure what happened, but I am absolutely positive what didn't happen. So that's my Occam's razor there on that technology. And by the way, the X-37B, you remember that? The little mini shuttle that we covered here several months ago? Its mission has suddenly been extended. So we also are working on the anywhere in the planet in 2 hours delivery craft. We can launch it into low orbit, and it can literally fly itself to any spot on the planet in 2 hours. There's not a whole lot that you can get done in 2 hours. Even a blitzkrieg needs more time than that. Hey, let's take a quick break. Listen to a little Enigma. We'll be right back after this. Don't go away. We'll be back with more X Squared Radio.
Mission is over.
And welcome back to X Squared Radio. December 11th, 2011. Coming to you from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachians, our AccuWindow forecast. 43 degrees, heading on down to about 39 degrees tonight. Still a beautiful full moon out, but if you missed the full lunar eclipse, you probably didn't live on the West Coast. Late at night, you should have been able to see it at least partially from just about anybody anywhere in North America. Kind of a beautiful reddish brown, and lunar eclipses take place in a pretty short amount of time, usually less than about an hour and 40 minutes, even a full lunar eclipse. So if you can stand it, stand outside with a hot cup of cocoa, you should be able to be quite amazed. I also, this is the third hour tonight, I do want to reiterate one more time about the Maya 2012 event. This is really, really going to be a fantastic event. Click on the orange banner, Maya 2012 banner at X Squared Radio. And I would start, you know, right away. I know it's December 13th, 2012 when this thing starts. We're flying all out of Houston, so everything is included from the time you leave Houston to the time you return back to Houston. So you get yourself to and from Houston, you've got it made. And you can join me and Greg Braden and several of the other world authorities on the subject of 2012 at Chichen Itza, Ground Zero for 2012. That's where this whole thing started, down near the area of Piedras Negras, which is the area where Pakal's tomb lid, you know, remember the giant king and his giant king son, studied this intensively and made predictions based off of the calendar that predated them several thousand years, made by the Tzolk'in wheels, which were a mathematical system of wheels designed to tell time. By the way, Rico Paganini just finished his book, Dei Legacy, that's D-E-I, Legacy, where he ties the four ancient calendars, none of which are based on religion. All the calendars that we use today in the world are based on religion. These are based on an ancient, ancient mathematical system. It goes back tens of thousands of years, which links the traverse of our solar system through the precession. And we are about to come to the end of the age, the end of the age of Pisces that was predicted by many great holy men and philosophers around the world. Even Jesus spoke of events that would happen at the end of the age. Well, folks, we're there. In 20 days, we will enter the year 2012. This is the zenith. This is the apex of all the events that have built up from, you know, the time the Earth cooled, or at least from the last catastrophe, to now. Now, when December 13th comes, they're not going to be over. Or December 22nd comes, they're not going to be over. They're going to continue because we're going down the other side of the bell curve of these events. Now, some of you have written me and asked me, is there a link between weather and earthquakes? You know, when I grew up in California, we had four seasons. You know, just like you have in the north, only different. We had flood, we had drought, we had wind, and we had earthquake. Those were our four seasons. We had a season where earthquakes occurred. And it just seemed that it was those crazy days when we had 80-degree days and 40-degree nights. Back to back to back to back. It just seemed like we're always due a big earthquake. And, you know, it's just an observation, just an observation. When you have these hot days and cool nights, I don't know why, just somehow we always seem to have a pretty big earthquake when that happened. Well, lots of studies have been done, and I read many of those studies this week just because you've been writing me and asking me about it. And what I've discovered is that the experts are saying there's no correlation between weather and earthquakes. However, the amount of damage sustained by the earthquakes is related to weather. oftentimes if we have periods where we have a lot of rain and the ground is all soaked and everything's unstable, especially hillsides, and then you have an earthquake, you have what's called liquefaction. It's a little bit like going to the beach, you know, the wet sand part of the beach, and then taking your foot on the sand and stepping on it and up, step on it and up, step on it and up. You're pumping the water up into the soil with the pressure that you're applying. And it creates a sort of liquefaction where you can literally sink into the sand. Well, that's what happens, especially when in more clay areas, the soil can actually turn to mud just by this vibrational pumping of water through the soil. So, you know, the actual damage sustained by the earthquakes can be greater. But they did say something in the articles, and our good friend Stan Deo did a study of this when he had access to the Naval Thermal Imaging Satellites, that hotspots or differentials in temperature that occur anomalously do precede earthquakes. And he was very successful, Stan Deo was, in predicting several major quakes, so much so that experts began to be interested in what he was doing. Shortly thereafter, they cut him off from access to the naval satellites. You know, maybe, I don't understand why, would we love to have an early warning system for earthquakes? I think so, sure, unless we actually didn't want a warning system, or we only wanted certain people to be warned and not others, but I just can't imagine anything like that occurring. The truth is that when these temperature anomalies occur, hot spots, cool spots, and some of these change temperature within, a very short amount of time, 1 or 2 days, and it usually precedes the earthquake within 24 hours. These do have an effect. Now, is that caused by weather? Is it related to weather? Can it spill off into weather or climate changes? It's possible. But studying weather as an indicator for earthquakes is probably not productive. It's not going to work out as a scatter plot or an ability to statistically nail down when and where and how strong an earthquake is going to occur. But these thermal differences in the ground or in water are definitely a telltale sign. Just to give you the update, you asked for it. All right. You know, in all levels of government, everywhere, even science, there are people with sticky fingers. Well, researchers have sticky fingers when it comes to NASA's moon rocks and meteorites. And hundreds of samples have gone missing after being loaned out by the U.S. Space Agency, an audit said Thursday. Yeah, they actually audited all of the moon rocks that were brought back during the missions to the moon. And they came up short. Researchers have been, I don't know if they've been charged, but NASA Inspector General Paul Martin issued a report detailing foibles. That's an official term. Foibles, such as the U.S. Space Agency making loans to researchers who never used the samples or simply losing track of rare pieces dating back to the first U.S. trip to the moon in 1969. According to NASA record, according to NASA records, 517 loaned astromaterials had been lost or stolen between 1970 and June 2010, said the report. Astromaterials include moon rocks and soil, spaceship parts. No, I put that part in. No spaceship parts. Meteorites from asteroids, Mars and the moon, ions from the outer layers of the sun, dust from comets and interstellar space, and cosmic dust from Earth's stratosphere. And you can get those yourself. All you need is a big latex balloon, a bunch of helium, and a little collector, a little, you know, sticky ball or something like that that can collect dust, and you can do that yourself. You remember the little, what was a 9-year-old kid and his dad put a movie camera and an iPhone into a styrofoam cooler and launched it up to 100,000 feet and it took the photographs and then parachuted back down to Earth. Oh, that was cool. Yeah, if you haven't seen the YouTube of that, you need to go see it. That's really something. It took, I don't know, something like 2.5 hours for this thing to go up and come down, and it landed within 30 miles of where they were. So it was pretty fantastic. These samples constitute a rare and limited resource and serve an important role for research and education. Specifically, the group found that NASA records were inaccurate and that researchers could not account for all samples loaned to them and held samples for extended periods without performing research or returning the samples to NASA. NASA needs a better tracking system and should do an annual inventory to stop unnecessary sample loss, the audit said. NASA concurred with our recommendations and promised to take corrective action. As of March, NASA had more than 26,000 samples on loan. That's a lot of samples. And a collection that totals 140,000 lunar samples, 18,000 meteorite samples, and 5,000 solar wind, comet, and cosmic dust samples. NASA has admitted to losing such materials in the past. One researcher lost 18 lunar samples in 2010. Well, so if you have any of these lunar samples, any of these astro materials, you can send them here to X Squared Radio. We'll take care of them for you. Yeah, I think, you know, these things need to be visible by the public, but not in someone's private collection at their home. Just my opinion. If you have a different opinion, I'd love to hear about it. You can call me toll-free, 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471, or anywhere else on planet or off planet at 530-413-4511. Also, in the very strange anomalous weather news, have you heard about the Scottish winds? Yeah, a fierce storm with winds of up to 165 miles an hour has battered northern parts of Britain, with people warned to stay indoors, schools forced to close, and flights and rail links canceled. 165 miles an hour—that's getting on up there. That's hurricane force winds. That's about what we'd see in an average tornado. And these are straight line winds coming in off the North Sea. Talk about a rugged people. Wow. I mean, it's one thing to have those kinds of winds, you know, in Nebraska or Kansas or Oklahoma. They come and they go. This is a straight line wind coming off the ocean. That's the kind of cold that just cuts right to the bone. Localized flooding has also caused major disruptions on roads, and more than 30,000 homes have been left without power. In North Yorkshire, a RAF helicopter plucked a couple to safety after their car was swept away in floodwaters near Aysgarth. They were flown to hospital with suspected hypothermia, freezing their butts off. A third person was also rescued from his car in a separate incident near the village of Gunnerside. Police have advised against all travel until at least 2 a.m. on Friday, when winds are expected to ease. The MET office earlier issued its strongest warning, a red alert for winds in Scotland, and warned parts of England and Wales to be aware as temperatures were expected to drop and snowfall was predicted as far south as Birmingham. Yeah, snow at 165 miles an hour will drift rather dramatically. It is said the Highland Observing Station at Glen Ogle reported a gust of 104 miles per hour at 11 a.m. The Met office later tweeted that a gust at the Annagh Moor ski area peaked at 137 miles per hour. Pretty fantastic stuff. And we see winds like that too in North Carolina. If you go up to Boone, you get up in the areas up there, high up in the mountains, there have been gusts 140, 150 miles an hour. There as they come whipping through the Appalachians. So it's not that strange. I haven't seen winds like that in a long time off the ocean, but without really a storm front coming in with it, and that's just weather strangeness, and we like to talk about such things here at X Squared Radio. So we have roughly half an hour left, and I want to open the phone lines up so you can call in. I have one more news story. I picked this up because I found it interesting. When I grew up in Southern California, and we used to go bonita fishing down at Redondo Beach. Well, down at Redondo, there's also a power plant, and the power plant puts out, well, it uses seawater for cooling water, and it pumps the warmed water back out into an artificial bay that's kind of created there at Redondo. And so it raises the water temperature. And if you've ever been to the Southern Pacific there in California, the water is pretty chilly. It isn't anything like Florida water. You don't go out there with, you know, 80 and 90 degree water and swim. In the hottest summers, when it's like 100 degrees on the beach, I mean, you literally cannot walk on the beach without sandals because the sand absorbs so much infrared radiation from the sun that it will burn your feet, literally, just cook your feet. So you have to wear flip-flops or tennis shoes or something like that to walk from your towel back to Hamburger Haven to get a corn dog and a lemonade. But the water doesn't get nearly that warm. On a really hot day, the water gets up to about 75 degrees. That takes a little bit of getting used to. Now, you know, when you surf down there off Santa Monica, the difference between the water temperature and the air temperature is kind of refreshing, but it does take getting used to. You don't just jump out there in the water and feel comfortable. Not if you're used to you know, Gulf waters or Florida waters. It's chilly. But at Redondo, it was kind of interesting because the plant would actually heat up the seawater in that bay enough that the bonita fishing was phenomenal because the bonita like warmer water and they swim in little schools of six or eight fish. And it's kind of fun to fish for them. You go out on a boat, you cast out with a lure, a spinning lure, a little red and silver lure, and they hit that thing going about 90 miles an hour, and it's a fun 20-minute fight to haul in a bonita, which is in a tuna family. Not really that bad eaten either. Striped kind of fish, but very fast. If a barracuda doesn't take it off at the gills before you get it in the boat. Well, in Florida, there's a nuclear power plant that also uses seawater for cooling water. And it warms up the waters of the area. And it has had its effect. Once on the endangered species list, the American crocodile has flourished in a most unlikely place, in the shadow of a nuclear power plant. The plant, FPL's Turkey Point Nuclear Power Plant, uses over 150 miles of man-made canals to help cool the atomic-fueled operation. The canals act as a natural habitat, and because the site is on FPL land, rarely sees human activity. That's where Bob Bertelsen and Mario Aldecoa come in. They work for FPL's land utilization unit in monitoring the groundwater and wildlife on the sprawling property. Bertelsen says he's seen a tenfold increase in the number of crocs in the past 20 years. No, there's no three-eyed crocs, okay? No, there's no dino crocs, okay? None of the crocs are radioactive. No dino crocs, okay? Everything is under control, nothing to worry about. It's just the crocs like the extra warm water, and the eggs hatch out nicely, obviously, there's a lot for the crocs to eat, which means that the fish are also doing quite well, having the water warmed, especially in the wintertime, does create an environmental difference that changes the ecosystem a little bit. And so you have more predators, which means there are also more prey because crocs don't grow if there isn't enough to eat. And I don't know what the natural enemy to the crocodile is. If you know it, I appreciate a phone call on it. 888-429-5471. 888-429-5471. Anywhere in North America, if you know the answer. Does a crocodile have a natural enemy unless it's an anaconda? But I don't think anacondas live in the Florida Everglades. Leastways, haven't seen any news on that. Anacondas are a bad snake. I looked at some photos of the anaconda's mouth, and it looks a little bit like the mouth of one of those flying beasts in Avatar, with the teeth down both sides, razor sharp teeth. Once it grabs a hold of something, I don't think it could let go if it was asked to. When we next week will be the 18th of December. We will have a program. We're not going to have a program on December 25th. So if you're doing something else on Christmas Day, have at it, because there won't be a live program of X Squared Radio. We're going to take a break that day. The following week will be New Year's Day. We may have a program on that day. Jury is still out. I just don't know. It depends on what happens in the news. You know, a lot happens in the news, and we make a lot of notes for this program to start it off. In our first hour, we went over literally the science, the mathematics, the statistics of the ancient alchemy of the Nephilim to take over the planet with economic force or economic forces. And we listened to an interview by Ann Barnhart, who is a commodities broker, was a commodities broker until she was, by her own accounts, closed her firm in order to protect her clients' money. I don't know if you guys have any money in those accounts. Some of you, you know, have 401ks or Roths or self-directed IRAs. You may have had money that clears through MF Global, in which case my condolences go out to you. I have had a 401k since I was in my 20s, which was a long time ago, and it was doing quite well up until about 2004, something like that. And then the fund managers didn't do very well with it, and it lost about 65% of its value. So I cashed out of my 401k. Didn't take very long. Wasn't that hard to do. Paid my 10% penalty. And I took the cash, and I paid off all my debts. I had, you know, as many of you do, had a lot of credit card debt, paid all that off, removed the credit cards from service for good, and I haven't had one since. I don't need one. I have money in the bank, and I use a debit card for everything. I recommend you doing the same thing. I think that, you know, retiring with millions of dollars in the bank as you let these things build interest, the way the fund managers have tried to advertise, that's the way it's going to work out. The way brokers and financial planners and financial analysts have tried to convince you all of your life, that's how to build wealth. You'd be surprised how little you need and how little you're obligated to work in the way that you work now when you have no debt. When you take away the payments on everything, your home, your cars, everything you own is paid for, then all your money becomes food, cell phone, insurance. You can live on so much less. And because you can live on so much less, what you do for a living doesn't have to be any different than what you love doing. If you love doing something and it doesn't pay as well as what you hate, but you'll work what you hate because you're obligated to it and you have responsibilities. But when you take your cash and you pay off all those indebtedness, get yourself out of slavery, then you can do what you love doing, and you can get by on far less. You don't need to make $100,000 a year. If you remove all the indebtedness in your life, you could live quite well on $30,000 a year or $40,000 a year or even less than that. You can work from contract to contract, work during the summer and take the rest of the year off. Do what you love doing and never settle. All right, let's go to the phones. Brent from Oregon, line 3, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Brooks. I actually met you at ESETI and talked to you there and attended a couple of conferences. And in 2010, I heard you, and then I met you again this year in 2011. Listen to this entire program. You've covered a lot of territory here. And so I guess I could probably respond to any of the subjects you've covered, including the financial ones. So why don't you go ahead and give me a question, and I'll see if I can answer you.
Well, I mean, what did you think about, Anne had this, I'm going to call it a vitriolic energy about her. She was just, you know, calling Corzine a criminal and evil. And I think that's, you know, very energetic myself. What did you think of her analysis of what's going on?
I think she's right on. I heard a very similar radio interview just today from Jim Willey, who puts out the Hat Trick newsletter. I don't know if you're familiar with him.
No, but I'm writing it down.
And I can send you an email on this too, but his website's The Golden Jackass, and he was and his newsletter's The Hat Trick Letter, and he was saying the very same kinds of things, except went on, you know, beyond MF. And was saying that, the other kinds of accounts are going to be raided, including mutual funds and 401ks and this kind of thing. So I can go ahead and forward you that radio interview. It's an MP3 if you wish. But it just very much echoed everything that you were saying in that interview that you had this evening. And so I've been an investor for a long, long time, and started to become aware of the things that were going awry, I don't know, 6 or 7 years ago, and moved all of my investments out of dollar-denominated investments and started getting involved in commodities and various overseas investments. And interestingly enough, I had been a student of the Mayan calendar, among many other subjects, for many years, and actually learned about the 2008 crash before it occurred, and actually moved investments before then. And one of my favorite authors and guides over the years has been Barbara Handclaw, who has written many books, including the Mayan Code, and she was writing about the 2008 crash several years before it happened, and something just resonated with me, and I said, wow, you know, this is right. I had an investment broker at the time, was all in American stocks and this kind of thing, and fired him and sold everything and moved.
Yeah, he argued with you, I'm sure, Brent. You probably said, oh, no, you don't need to do that.
He actually didn't. He said, well, you know, maybe someday, you know, if you can tell me what works, maybe we can talk about it and I can learn something from you. He was gracious about it.
Well, I found interesting is that
go ahead.
What I picked up on is in our second volume of The Ark of Millions of Years, we had this chapter called The Watchers. And I had, you know, carefully and statistically put together, if I were an ancient Nephilim and I wanted to take this alchemy to the extent that I'm going to take over the world without firing a shot, how would I do it? And so I carefully laid out this plan in the book. And what I see John Corzine doing is impossible unless Securities and Exchange Commission is tied into it, unless the presidency is tied into it, unless the Department of Justice and other financial powerhouses like what we have, Wall Street here, other exchanges around the world are in on it. And it appears that they all are in on it.
That's exactly right. I think you hit the nail on the head once again with that. And I've studied some of the same things that you have over the years, and I do indeed think that it goes back to Genesis right there, where they talked about the Elohim and the Nephilim, and I think that's how far it goes back, and that those individuals are at the very top of the pyramid, and they're hidden from view, but things are becoming more and more and more blatant. And the people that are in public speaking roles, they all sound like they're stupid, and maybe some of the ones in the lower echelons really are, the politicians and the president, and they're all compartmentalized, and they're working for people in the higher levels, and they're doing what they're told to do. Because if they don't, they get taken out. Like,
well, that's true.
JFK, I mean, you know, was the last president that really tried to change anything.
Yeah, we're in a position right now, and you see this seething in the Occupy Wall Street movement, although they haven't actually come out and said it. You know, they're against corporations, they're against, you know, bankers and blah, blah, blah. I think they're misguided. I think they need to be guided. They need to have a good spokesman, and I've implored people on this program, why don't you put a name and a face on a sign and stand out there and ask for the resignation of the SEC chairman? Ask for the resignation of Secretary Chu at the Department of Energy. Let's take these bureaucrats out of office by public demand. Now, we are going to overreact, I think, in next November, and we're going to can a whole bunch of politicians and think that we fixed the problem. I've been to Washington lots of times. I sit down and talk with the congressmen. They're treated as temps in Washington. Nobody pays any attention to Congress whatsoever. This is much, much higher in power than that.
Oh, indeed it is. And they're bought, too. I mean, it's like one of the – there's a number of systemic fatal flaws in the government. And one of them is that corporations are treated like people, and that money is treated like free speech. And you're probably familiar with Dylan Radigan, and he's gotten a petition to amend the Constitution to change just those things. And I understand he's got over a quarter of a million signatures on it right now.
We've spoken about the fact that there are 32 states that have passed sovereignty acts, and we only need five more. Five more states.
Yeah.
We'll have 37 states. We now have enough for a constitutional convention that makes sense, and we could. I have a draft of something that I call the Departmental Freedom Act, and what it does is it makes it specifically illegal for the federal government to run departments, agencies, and bureaus like the DOE and the Department of Education and Commerce and all of that. They have to be jointly run by councils of states, and the people that run those organizations are appointed by state legislators, which respond much more quickly to the general public. If there's corruption, the
Absolutely.
Public responds very quickly.
Yeah, that is exactly right, and I think we do need to rise up state by state and take control of the country again on a local level, pass laws on a local level that supersede some of the federal laws that we're being held to. And one of the things that I followed very closely is the last bill that got passed by the Senate, S-1867.
Right.
Essentially makes it
the United States is now
part of the battlefield, and that the military can come in, and if you're just a suspected terrorist, you can be incarcerated or taken into custody without any due process and held indefinitely. Was completely blacked out of the news, the mainstream news, and I wrote letters to my congressman. I signed petitions, and living in Oregon, I think our two senators were the only two senators in any one state that actually voted against 1867.
Wow.
And,
it's
been passed. I think the vote was 93-7 to pass it. And it's now just up to Obama to either sign it in the law or veto it. I heard just yesterday that it was an announcement from the White House press secretary that, well, they are thinking about vetoing it, but the words were a little bit ominous that went with it, because they didn't think they thought that passing 1867 didn't give them enough flexibility in dealing with suspected terrorists, and I'm not exactly sure what they meant by that. But in order to be suspected terrorist, all it takes is to have more than 7 days worth of food supply in your house, or have any ammunition or guns, or
refuse to pay your taxes.
The last thing. Or be missing a finger. Yeah. So this is kind of like the last vestige of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights that's being railroaded through to be taken away from us. And I think, you know, we need to rise up on that. There's another petition that's going around for people to sign to impeach all of the congressmen that have voted for this this bill. And it just makes me wonder, why was there so many people, 93 out of 100, that voted to ram this through? What are they so scared of?
I know that the Occupy movement scares a lot of people because they don't know what direction it's going. They don't have a head that they can excoriate. They don't have somebody that they can, you know, go back into their childhood and, you know, pull up all the bad things that they did when they were a kid so that people will become disenfranchised with the leadership. There is no leadership to the Occupy movement. But, you know, if it makes it through the winter, and I believe that it will because it has the support of a lot of people, including Jesse Ventura and others, in the spring and through the summer, the nation's going to have its hands full. And, know, the extent to which law enforcement uses force to get these movements out of our cities will determine the intensity and the effect that they have on the next election.
Anything that they do will just be, I think people will respond that much more vigorously to anything they do to try to stop it. And as you said, there is no head. And this, I think, may be the beginning of a massive wave of unity consciousness that's starting to pervade the world.
Well, it's not just here. You're absolutely right. I mean, Russia had 60,000 in the streets yesterday.
Yeah. And I think the powers that were, they're terrified, because there is no one that they can attack. It is a mass rising. It's a wave of consciousness of all of the people together. That they're not focused yet. If there's some kind of catastrophe that happens, like the crash of the U.S. dollar or whatnot, it may give candidates like Ron Paul the ability to really be elected. He won't have enough support from the mainstream the way things are right now. But if the dollar crashes or something else in addition to that happens, it may just, you know, make him popular enough to elect.
Well, I think that's really what's worried the GOP right now. You know, just the political science of it is the GOP likes a nice, predictable, you know, good hair, lots of money, tall person to put into an election. That's just the typical GOP way. I was driving around one day and Sean Hannity was on, and I called up Sean Hannity, and of course the screener asked me the question. I said, listen, Sean Hannity is exactly what's wrong with the GOP today. Well, naturally, they moved me right to the head of the line. Boom, I was on. And I said, look, you guys, the GOP, what is wrong with the party are guys just like you. You want the guy that's tall, that's good looking, that has the great hair, has lots of campaign money. And that's the guy that you put in front of the GOP as the candidate when we run for presidencies. You need to learn from the Democrats. They can take a nobody. They can take a street thug union organizer that nobody knows at all, never heard of him, and they can make him president. That's what you guys need to figure out. Take the guy who can take you all the way and make him the candidate and back him, and he'll win.
Well, that may be the case, but the way the system's set up now, it really doesn't matter which party's in power or who becomes president. I think Ron Paul could change that if conditions are right, but
yep.
Up until this point, it really doesn't matter. The flavor of the rhetoric changes, and depending on whether it's a Democrat or a Republican, and it gives people the illusion that voting really makes a difference in what happens in the events of the world that unfold, but it's really not any more valuable than watching a professional wrestling match. I mean, it's just like it's something to keep people occupied, where, like you were saying earlier in the show, it's really these people that are hidden, the ones that are not in the public light, that are calling the shots. And so it doesn't matter who the mouthpiece is, and what they say never matches what they do. You got to watch what they do.
Well, that's true. And I think when we talk on this program about throwing everyone out of office that's been in there three or more terms, you know, you're talking about getting rid of 260, 270 lawmakers. When you do that,
right,
you send a message to Washington that we're not going to take it anymore. Now, when we send you guys to Washington, you work in a unified manner. You go 435 strong to the Department of Energy, and you could take that place apart brick by brick. But if you show up two or three at a time, they will throw you out with the trash.
Right. But who is offered for a replacement? And I agree with you, throwing the incumbents out is a place to start, but who is there to replace them? I mean, is there going to be anyone better to choose from?
I would choose from school teachers, bus drivers, engineers, doctors. Come on.
Absolutely.
If we can come up with 135 smart people in this country to send to Washington to represent us in a republic, we're in big trouble.
Yeah. Well, definitely it should be the people that are most respected for their accomplishments and their views and their ethics and their moral values, their spiritual values, and not just the power and the greed and the people that have the charisma to be able to convince voters that they should be in power.
Well, exactly. And just like Ann was saying, you got guys like Harry Reid that go in there with a six-figure net worth, somewhere in the $300,000 or $400,000 net worth range, and after a few terms, he's worth $10-12 million. I'm sorry,
right,
that's just
right.
Statistically impossible.
It is, and there was an investigation. I don't remember which who's actually running it, but that they had uncovered enough information to accuse the congressman of insider information and, using insider information to do trading, and they're just, they're scoffing at it. But I think you're exactly right. They know what's going to happen before it does, and so they can sell things short or they can take investments out, and they have links that no honest human being has to make themselves wealthy.
Now, the sad part is it's perfectly legal, just like the guy that, bought the piece of junk property and then passed an earmark to run a major highway right next to his property, making the property worth millions of dollars. I'm sorry,
yeah.
That's got to be illegal. Unfortunately, right now it is not illegal, but, I see the complexity of it. You got a guy that goes to Washington and he's got a ton of different stock holdings and stuff like that. It's inevitable that some legislation that he passes is going to affect those stocks one way or another. He's going to call up his broker and say, hey, dump all these medical stocks I have. I'm going about to make it, illegal to use asthma spray or whatever. It's bound to happen. But you have to make it illegal. and you've got to prosecute it when it happens.
That's exactly right. I think one of the redeeming things that's occurring now is that all of this stuff is really starting to be exposed and starting to crash, and more things like this this MF scandal and things like it are coming to public light. So hopefully enough people will wake up in time to be able to turn things around.
Well, I don't know. I have my doubts. I think somewhere along the line, we've got to do a massive Control-Alt-Delete and reset this whole thing.
That's exactly right.
We can't go on $100 trillion in debt when we only have a $70 trillion global economy. It doesn't work out.
That's right. And yet our country is still running on, I mean, it's running on nothing more than just electronically counterfeited money. And
I like the way you say that. That's exactly right.
Yeah, the Federal Reserve, their role, of course. I mean, Bernanke comes on, and the things he says, it's like he doesn't know what's going on. He's just, he never admits doing anything wrong, but what he's doing is criminal. And if you think about the balance of the amount of currency that's in circulation versus the amount of goods and services that are actually being produced, there has to be a correlation there. And when he's flooding the system with currency that has no correlation to what's been produced, it's just like, imagine an auction where a number of, let's say 10 bidders come to that auction and they're going to bid on some goods and services, and each one has $100. And so their job is to buy the goods and services that are available. Well, what if each bidder showed up with $1,000 and the same goods and services were there to be bid upon? What do you think is going to happen to the prices that they pay?
Well, the price would go up, but the value is the same.
That's right, but the prices are going to go up because there's more currency available to bid with. And that's exactly what's going on in the economy. And it's just like, on the surface, it's like, well, there's a desperate bid that we can spend ourselves out of this problem. But the very problem is caused by excessive debt and consumption, and it can't work. I mean,
well,
if you go to the Federal Reserve's, go ahead.
The whole science of economics is that there's always a less value in the system than there is cash that's flowing in the system. The key to making it work is keeping the money moving in the system. And it's sort of like, being a building contractor. You get your first draw to build the first house, and so you draw that money, you get it to the second stage, and then you make your next draw. But by then, your payroll is caught up, you've had weather delays and sub delays, so you have to start another house. So you start another house, and you get the first draw on that one, then that cash flow from the second house gets you through the first house. Then you sell the first house, catch up on that cash flow, and you create this giant momentous snowball. And it might work very well for 3 or 4 years. And then what's going to happen is you can't start enough houses to cover your cash flow. You're bankrupt. You're broke. That's what's happening.
It's like you can't keep adding more snow to the snowball without it meaning anything.
Yeah, exactly right. And whether you're a gem craft building 5,500 homes in a year in 9 different states, or whether you're a local building contractor building 15 custom homes, it's the same problem. But what happens when the cash stops moving in the system, you have a domino effect. And all of these organizations that are running on cash flow instead of profit die. And that's what's happened to our business. The whole textile industry ran on cash flow, not profit. They were factoring all their invoices. So they were living on the cash flow. And what happened when foreign imports started coming in, and the cash stopped moving, the purchase order stopped coming, they went broke. And that's what happened to American manufacturing. I know, I'm an American manufacturer, and we're at a standstill right now. Of course, we're debt-free, we're not making anything, but we're not going in the hole either. There are a lot of industries didn't have what we had. They weren't debt-free, and the debt caught them and buried them.
Yeah, and there's more to it than just moving the cash. I mean, it's like when I was a child, and I'm a little bit older than you are. I mean, our economy was based on production and savings, and that's the only real source for capital is people saving money and then investing in things to make a better future. And now, over the last 50 years or so, it's transformed into an economy of consumption and debt. And we can't really base an economy on consumption and debt. And we're now the biggest debtors on the planet. Back at the end of World War II, the United States was the biggest creditor. We had the lion's share of the gold. We had an economy that really produced stuff. We made the best products in the world. And over all this time, that's completely changed around. And all we're doing is funding it with IOUs, and that can't continue.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You're exactly right. But, I don't know how it can end. We can't take all the housing back to 25 cents on the dollar and start over again, because all those people that have those mortgages, the mortgages are going to be worthless. And I know people who let their houses be foreclosed, had cash, turned around and bought a house that had been foreclosed on at cash, moved up, and have no debt.
Yeah. It's run its course, I do believe, and that I think the saving grace is that we're going to see a crash happen, but it's not affecting all of the resources that are really here. It's affecting the units of measure and a breakdown in the infrastructure. And it's like, we still have wood, we still have, the basic things, iron and steel and aluminum and copper. It's a breakdown in the units of measure. It's like you're saying, you can't keep building houses because the carpenter ran out of inches. You know, it's like, it doesn't matter. As long as he's got wood, we can build houses. It's the infrastructure that's going to have to collapse in terms of the units of measure and be rebuilt with something that's meaningful. And the units of measure are dollars, and they're going to become worthless.
That's true. So,
get back to something where we have a medium of exchange that is perhaps built on something that's fungible and actually an actual asset. I mean, there's talk of going back to the gold standard and the silver, using gold and silver. I mean, that's mandated in our Constitution that money can only be coined in gold and silver. And, of course, the Federal Reserve, I don't know how many people are aware of it, it's not really part of the government. It is an entity consisting of a private cartel of bankers, specifically to get around that requirement in the Constitution that we had to coin money in gold and silver, and so they can inflate and turn, and they have very successfully transformed us into where we're now based on nothing but a fiat currency. There is no value to the currency. It's strictly a matter of people's impression that it ought to be worth something. If they have faith in it, then it's worth something. And that has to change.
I couldn't agree with you more, and I think there's only one candidate that has long been talking about that, makes no bones about it, grills Bernanke like a redheaded stepchild, and I believe will do something about it, and that's Ron Paul.
That's exactly right. And it's a matter of getting enough people behind him, because he is the only one that really is willing and has the guts to stand up and be an agent for change. and I think he really believes what he's talking about. It's interesting that I was just watching one of his ads the other day, and it sounds like of the active members in the armed services, he has collected more campaign donations from the active members of armed services than all of the other candidates combined. Now, there's a message in that. 70% of the donations have been for him and not for the others.
Yeah, I believe that. Well, Brent, I would like to talk for hours, but we're out of time.
I'm afraid I probably took more time than I should have.
You're fine.
I guess I was the only caller that got on, but it's been a pleasure, Brooks, to talk to you, and I would like to see you again at some point. I love to hear you speak, and we're definitely on the same wavelength.
Well, you need to be at that Maya 2012 event on December 21st, 2012 at Chichen Itza.
I may just do that with you, or the other event that you talked about in Indiana. I don't remember the name of it now, but it's
Kentucky. It's called the Pythagoras Conference.
Yeah, you know, it's a matter of choosing these things.
Yeah,
and where do we put our energy? The intellectual part of me is so curious to keep up with all of the mind knowledge, but it always comes back down to practicing. And I say, you know, is anything I'm learning changing what I'm doing? No. I mean, I have a practice, spiritual practice, and my goal is to raise my energy as high as I can, thereby adding to the field of the energy of all the others that are doing the same thing. And we are creating a wave that I think is going to make a huge difference in this planet.
No question about it. No question about it. And your being here tonight is part of that. I really appreciate you coming on the program, and you're welcome to call back anytime.
Thanks a lot.
All right. We'll talk at you later.
To you. Okay. Take care.
Good night. All right, Earth Explorers, we ran just a little bit over time, but I know that you are sympathetic to my needs. So I'll go ahead and play my ending, and we'll move on out of here. We'll see you again next week.
It's been a pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.